Good to be here with you. I've been greetings from a great many of your brothers and sisters from Grange and from the United States and from Thailand and other places I've visited where God's people seem to have been scattered all over the place. Hi, Dwyer. Finally saw you. He was a little kid when I was growing up. Still a little kid. Wife's older, though. No, it's good to see friends from all over. There's so many people and places and things that that when we go somewhere, we always meet people that are part of our history. I've been with the church for most all my life. So a little history there. I had a birthday party my first year. I remember because of the photograph my mom has. That's about it. And then my mom came into the church, started listening to Mr. Armstrong, and my father had a problem with Sabbath because he was in construction. And then he died in a construction accident when I was about three. And so my mom was told by Mr. Blackwell, who did the funeral, that mom should go down where the widows go to Big Sandy. So I moved to Big Sandy and was there a few years, and then moved to Pasadena and finished that and went to college. And on graduation day, Mr. Armstrong asked me to fly with him. And so it was an unusual career, having spanned different campuses and knowing all the people involved and the places and things and what happened. So it was good. And being younger than everybody else, Mr. Armstrong was 60 years older than I was, and I never thought my closest friend would be 60 years older than I was. And so I started flying with him at age 20. And it was funny because I told him I was catching up with him, because when I was 20, I was one quarter his age, and when I was 30, I was one third his age. And enough time would go by, I'd surely catch up. Now I'm gaining ground faster because he's dead, so he quit counting. And I just turned 50 last Friday, so I would have been getting much closer. There are so many things that happened during the later years of the church, and all the way through the church, I mean, from the first century on. To me, it's nothing new in some ways to see what happened in the last 100 years if you look at the first century, and to make the book of Acts a lot more real to you, to understand why and who. I mean, who were turning in the Christians, who was reporting on who was who. To the Romans, a Jew was a Jew, and how would they know? They both kept the Sabbath. How would they know who was a Christian and who wasn't, and who to martyr and who not to martyr, and those type of things. But when you see some of our history as well, you understand the scriptures where it says people creep in unawares. You understand the jealousies, and you understand the people that don't grow into mature Christians the way they should. And then when you look at yourself, and none of us have done it perfectly, and we get upset at times too. So you understand that, and you realize that there are hurts and offenses and things that we create even among people that do have God's Spirit. So from my standpoint, I've not delineated or differentiated a whole lot from the standpoint of membership in the spiritual body of Christ. One of the things Mr. Armstrong consistently did with the lawyers, especially Mr. Huggy, when he made a comment about Worldwide Church of God, Mr. Armstrong popped his fist on the table. The Worldwide Church of God is 7 board members. The church is a spiritual organism. Well, for me, all those years growing up, the same thing. You know, one and the same. Well, what's the difference? But if you go back to the autobiography, and he'd talk about the days when some people came in, the man who took over the church and got the building, and that the judge, you know, criticized on all the problems he had. He recognized the fact that the church was a spiritual organism and that there was that distinction. And for us, it took the same thing virtually that happened to him. Someone taking over the church, stealing the assets, lying about everything, to have us realize, or at least for me to realize that, yeah, it really is a spiritual organism. It's not a corporation. Although a corporation is necessary. You couldn't rent a hall. You couldn't do the things you're doing here in the same way if you don't have one. And so from that point of view, we learn a lot of lessons. And to look at it now and to see why we're scattered, you know, and why Mr. Armstrong did what he did, there are so many questions that I raised of him even the last few months of his life. And again, there's a few of you new here, and I flew with him for 12 years and was aide the last 5, although I did all the same things the first 7 pretty much that I did the last 5, because just the nature of the people that flew with him, many of them really weren't converted, didn't really care as much about what he did as I did. So I was always there in the hotel room with him, even as a young steward, listening, reading his articles back to him and learning from him. And the only advantage I had then was that, not being his age during those years, at least I'd go back to my room and go eat and have a little bit of time. Although I was gone with my wife, it wasn't that much fun. But when I became his aide, basically 24 hours a day, I was pretty well bought. In fact, I had, the last 5 years of his life, I had 2 days off. And we're talking about 365 day years, not 5 day work weeks, because I had Thanksgiving day off 1 year and Christmas day off 1 year. Now, you probably wonder about Christmas. It wasn't because I was celebrating Christmas. It was because I actually had the students in Imperial ask me to be a chaperone for a ski party so I'd go skiing with them. And so they did, and I asked Mr. Armstrong, do you have to? And I said, they need me. Well, I got to go skiing one day. And I set him up with TV so he could do his work that day, and I arranged everything. But it was a full-time job. And the feasts were, first in the 70s, I went to almost every feast site in the United States. I saw all my friends for about 3 seconds each site. And if my wife happened to be at the site where we spent the night, I could sleep with her that night. If it was one of those we hopped through, I just kind of said hi to her and went on too. So she spent her feast with her grandmother, who was the only person in her family in the church, and I spent mine jumping around. So it was a difficult yet interesting and educational life for me. And one that, again, you have to wonder why God puts you where he does in different places. But it makes me an archive in a sense of what happened, who and what. And unfortunately, it's a necessary thing now because so many people have their own version of what Mr. Armstrong did and why he did it. So from his point of view, the major question people always ask is, why did he appoint Mr. DeCock? And I've been asked that from people inside, people outside. I got a call from the Wall Street Journal. They were doing an article. And I talked to this writer for about 3 hours. And he said, why didn't these people just go to their own church if they believe so differently? And so he asked the same question. And why did Mr. Armstrong appoint Mr. DeCock? And then the other question, did he appoint Mr. DeCock? So that's been out there. And then you've seen articles where, did Mr. DeCock or someone murder Mr. Armstrong? I mean, everything is out there. Believe me, everything is there. And yet at the same time, there's a grain of truth in almost every rumor out there in some manner. And when I do question and answers and things, I usually start my question and answer with a joke about a little boy in a restaurant who's sawing on a steak, and it's so tough he can barely get, he's just fighting this thing. And the waiter comes up and finally says, can I help you cut that? And the little boy looks up, oh no, we get steak this tough at home. Well, he's insulted the restaurant, but he doesn't know it. So I've never assumed people asking questions are trying to insult or anything but bring closure, and so I've answered questions about everything and anything. Whether it be yachts in Monte Carlo, which there was one. The story, the way it's told by those who dislike Mr. Armstrong or the church or whatever, is to try to paint it like where he went down there to have some kind of a vacation and luxury cruise and spend the church's money lavishly and enjoy life. Of course, he was 88 years old at the time, couldn't see, couldn't hear. Kind of hard to enjoy much of anything in Monte Carlo on a boat. And he only went on the boat once for a couple hours at the end of the trip. But their story is that he spent all this money to do this. And the truth of that one, I'll go ahead and tell it now to explain how people twist things. What happened, we were in Paris, the meeting that we had set up with one of the UN representatives from France was to take place about 10 days later. And his second wife, Ramona Armstrong, did not like Paris. Also, she did not like Stan Rader, who was also there in Paris. So she asked if we could go down and burn a sit, if we could sit in Monte Carlo. Mr. Armstrong's question was, is it cheaper in Monte Carlo than it is here? And it was much cheaper in Monte Carlo than in Paris. And so since it was cheaper, okay, we can go down there. He was also told by Stan Rader that, I have a friend down there that has a boat that you can use if you're down there. And Mrs. Armstrong had taken her son from her first marriage, which was a short marriage, years before he was 14 years old. And so we went down there, and he was working. He always worked. He sat in his room and typed and wrote articles, whatever. And I was usually there with him, but because her son was there, he asked me, you go with them to make sure he doesn't get in trouble, which was a job in itself. But we're on this boat, and there's this British couple and their son that is running this. And I'm talking to them, finally, this is a charter. This is not some private boat. And I said, this is not what Mr. Armstrong thinks it is. Well, every day, she's asking him to go on the boat. Stan Rader had arranged the boat through the concierge at the hotel in Paris, and he never came down there because he knew what he'd done. And Ramona, I think, wanted him out there on the boat so that he would use it so it would look more legitimate, I suppose. And he didn't want to go out. Well, the last day we're there, she talks him into going out for lunch. Okay, I'll go out and have lunch. And we take out the boat. We're going about an hour at best. And he says, I can't do any work out here. I can't do it. He said, turn this thing around. So he turned around. We ate lunch on the way back. And he got off. And so I told him, he said, well, you know, it's okay to have these things, but I need to work. And you know, Stan has his friend. I said, Mr. Armstrong, this is not a friend of Stan's boat. He says, yes, it is. I said, no, it's not. He said, oh, yes, Stan told me that. I said, Mr. Armstrong, that's not true. And I had to show him the invoice for the boat before he'd believe it. And boy, was he mad. Oh, you've never seen, well, yeah, I've seen that man several times. But I hadn't up to that point seen him. And he was so upset. And he just, but the thing is, he didn't come back to Pasadena and tell the whole church, you know what happened, and tell everybody. He just said, make sure this never happens again. Well, the funny thing, even with the boat, Monte Carlo was still cheaper than Paris would have been, so we saved money anyway. But it's funny because, in truth, rather than going down there to have fun and spend money, that he went down there to save money. And the boat was supposedly free, and he didn't know that. But yet someone in accounting who was upset and there were things spent and things done wrong during that time that others were doing, someone Xeroxed that invoice and passed it around, and then they tied their story to it. So what I mean is often things have a grain of truth to them in some form, but yet the real story behind it says a whole different meaning than what people place on it. And so sorting out those things, I even have pictures of the boat. It's called the Jolly Joker. I know everything. Full documentation. But people tend to twist things and say things that aren't true for their own cause. And again, it's designed, what is Satan? Deceiver of the brethren. And he says these things to get you upset. And I've had people write and call me, and still do, that sometimes say something like, you know, I don't believe in the religion or whatever, but just tell me, was Mr. Armstrong in it for the money? And I'll go through and tell some of these stories and explain to them, and they feel really good about that. And what's funny is a lot of them end up coming back to church, you know, wherever that church happens to be. I mean, some of them joined you and us and them and whoever else, and you know, it's a spiritual body. So from my standpoint, but it's one of those things where it gnaws on them to the point where they finally ask someone. And I've had so many people just say it's so nice that someone answered the questions and can explain what happened in each of these various instances, and whether it's moral sins or monetary, financial questions, whatever. I've answered all those to the best I can. At the same time, if someone sins, they sin, and if they repent, they're forgiven. And so you've got, you know, name me one person in the Bible other than Christ that you can go to, and if you weren't personally there, you would have been offended at something they did. No question about it, because we're all human and we all make mistakes. And so it behooves us as we mature not to offend. And yet, at times, we will. And, you know, hopefully it's because we see things differently, not because we're just adamant or belligerent or wrong, or trying to be like Satan and just cause problems. And there are people like that out there. There are some who claim to be religious who are simply in it for the money. I mean, I know that beyond a shadow of a doubt in a couple of cases because of things they've said and done. But for the most part, I think all of us are trying to get to the same place, into the kingdom of God. And that's where Mr. Armstrong wanted the church to be. And that was the thing on his deathbed that he wanted more than anything else the last few months, is for the church to be made ready to purify the bride of Christ. And he felt that, he said, you know, I think I've done the work, you know, that was supposed to be done, going to the nation, something like that. And next is purifying the bride. And I said, well, Mr. Armstrong, what are you saying? And then you die, then we quit doing anything. Yeah, I said a real great letter. So what are you going to write for your letter now? You're going to write a letter that I'm dying, I've done everything. Boy, just sit in your chair and hold on, and I hope you get there. I mean, I said, can you prove to me from the Bible where it says you quit? He said, well, no. And how totally done? No. Besides that, I said, you know, if you're alive and breathing and a church member, it says grow in grace and knowledge. You can't quit growing. And so when we went to work together, wrote his last letter he wrote out there, you know, saying to you know, go on and carry forth and et cetera. I could get the letter and read it out. But it was a matter of, he didn't know what was going to happen from the standpoint of what would be done. But he did know this. And he didn't know it from anything tangible, only from the scriptures and prophecies. He said, half the church is going to leave. He says, the church is going to quit keeping the Sabbath. He says, the money's going to drop. And, you know, all these things. And I said, Mr. Armstrong, well, how? Why will people quit tithing? Because you die. I mean, look in the scriptures, it's here. People will quit keeping the Sabbath. You know, Exodus 20, Deuteronomy 5, remember the Sabbath. I mean, how will people do that? I mean, to me, it was unheard of. My whole training was, this is the Bible. There was nothing else made any sense. And how would the church do this? He said, I don't know, but it's going to happen. And then the question is, why did he appoint Mr. Dukach? you know, because here's someone who let us drift into any kind of religion you want to have, except the truth. They're more focused on their prejudice against all of us. And the question was asked a number of times. Mr. Irish and I would discuss it, and he finally felt he needed to appoint someone. And I said, Mr. Armstrong, if God doesn't tell you, can you? Do you have the right? And, he had the physical right to appoint someone, but spiritually. And I would say, if God didn't tell you, then I don't think you can do it. And so he finally decided he had to. So he started going through all the different people. And he'd have one person that should be it, and then a month later he'd change his mind. And it changed several times over the last few months. Because Mr. Armstrong never really knew who it should be. Now, Mr. DeCotch was probably the least qualified of all the people because he wasn't that educated. Yet at the same time, a couple of things had happened. One, the receivership had kind of made a legend out of him, even though he didn't do all the things he gets credit for in the books that were written. But he led services there. The only reason he was left there to lead services is because he was considered the lowest minister on the totem pole, and they left him there to take her anointing and stuff while everybody else went to Tucson for the ministerial conference. And he did lead signs and conduct services and things, but he didn't run any of the things that were going on as far as the state and the law thing and the sit-ins and et cetera. But he was there. And also he was head of church administration. And Mr. Arson said, well, the church is the parent organization, really, of the foundation, the college, all that. And so therefore he should be in the hat. And that's the only reason he was put in the hat at all, was because of that. And so, as they went around and around and changed, and one thing was never written up or told, Mr. Armstrong had a stroke before he died, a month or two. And it was interesting because Dr. Clyde was going to die then. And he didn't. And it would have been somebody else in charge of the church. And the next day, a stroke where he couldn't talk. I mean, he'd go like that, and he'd get so frustrated because he knew in his mind what he's trying to say, but he couldn't say the words. I'd have to kind of guess, like, well, you want this? No, you want that? Oh, you want your robe? Okay. And he'd kind of shake his head. But he basically lost control, and the doctor said, this is it. And then the next day, bang, right back. Nothing. You wouldn't even know anything had happened. And so I began to realize in my mind, I said, you know, God is going to let him die on the person that he wants for whatever reason. And you wonder, you'd always wonder why, you know, why doesn't God just tell him? But it was interesting that when the documentation finally came out to be, you know, written up to pass all of, legally the titles and things, and I was talking to Mr. Link last night, and he actually had the document. I hadn't seen it since Mr. Armstrong had signed it. But when they were writing it, Mr. Hugg had written all these things that he'd be the president, pastor general, et cetera, all my titles. Mr. Armstrong wrote in there, because I was reading it to him, except that of apostle. And that's written in the document. All I tell it, except that he did not give any spiritual title to Mr. Armstrong. Now, some people may consider Pastor General a spiritual title, I suppose, but Mr. Armstrong didn't. That was more the physical title in the sense of administration. And Mr. Koch had to ask Mr. Armstrong to ordain him. Mr. Armstrong refused. He said, I cannot give a spiritual title that God hasn't told me to give. And so it wasn't given. And he asked more than once. He asked me to see if I could give Mr. Armstrong. I said, I don't make Mr. Armstrong do anything. I'm not going to ask him. In fact, I thought he was right. See, God didn't tell him, and so it's not going to happen. It was interesting because Mr. DeCotch, within a month or so of getting his job, tried to make himself apostle. And he had one of the staff people write and say he was an apostle. Someone he appointed turns around and writes and says, you're the apostle. And I saw the preliminary PGR, or Pastor General's report on that. I'll try to slow down. I need a big sign up here that says slow down. So everybody tells me up north too, slow down. I can give a 4-hour sermon in 30 minutes if I try. But in the Pastor General report, it had this article, a preliminary edition. And I went in to Mr. DeCotch and I just said, this isn't right. Now, one of the things you got to realize that Mr. Armstrong, when he was dying, he made me promise to be Mr. DeCotch's aide. He made me promise to help purify the bride. He made me promise to tell Mr. DeCotch if he was wrong. And I said, Mr. Armstrong, I said, you're asking me to tell my future boss when he makes a mistake. He said, well, you told me. And on rare occasions, he'd ask me questions, and on rare occasions, he'd say, have I done something? And I'd say, well, yeah, he did. And it was always a surprise. So the first time I did it, I wonder if the fire would come out from heaven. But it didn't. He was willing to listen, surprisingly enough. Didn't mean he didn't get upset. Didn't mean he didn't like what I was saying sometimes, because often I was bringing things to his attention that he needed to do that he was told before by his former legal and financial advisor that weren't required, yet were. So I was often taking things away from him that he had been told he was allowed to do. One of the things was accounting for his expense money. He never spent any expense money wrong. It was always for meals and things, but he was told he never had to write it down, what he spent, let alone anything. So when I told him that, he was upset. Well, I have to do the work. I can't spend my time counting money. I said, I'll count it for you. But I said, you have to do it. Well, Stan said I didn't have to do it. I said, well, I know he said that. And I told him that was wrong, and Stan chewed me out. He said, you don't ever tell Mr. Armstrong I'm his advisor. Well, I didn't. But I said, now that I'm here, you do. Well, you're not a lawyer. You're not an accountant. Call the legal office. Call the Arthur Anderson. Call. Of course, Arthur Anderson isn't a good name anymore. But so he did, and they said exactly what I said. And so we accounted for everything. And I told him, I said, Mr. Armstrong, one thing you got to realize is people know you, and most people won't tell you what they should. And so they're going to figure everybody else is going to be gutless like they were and not tell you. And so if it ever goes to court, they're going to say, well, I tried to tell Mr. Armstrong he should do this, and he wouldn't listen. He's just old and stubborn. Of course, some people paint him that way. And I said, here, if you go to court and I'm there, I said, here you got the CPA lawyer, number one student in USC, and he stands up. So I tried to tell him to do this, and he wouldn't do it. Then you got this 27-year-old kid, because that's what I was when I became his aide, who has a theology degree, who says, Mr. Armstrong, you need to do this. And you do it. Who's lying? And the judge is going to say, yeah, the lawyer CPA couldn't convince you, but this theology kid can't. Yeah. I said, it'll show who was telling the truth in this whole thing. So he liked that, and it wasn't a problem, but he had to explain a lot of things like that to him. And so when he asked me to tell Mr. Koch, so I had to tell Mr. Koch when I saw something, and I did it respectfully. Mr. Koch didn't like hearing it. And I went in to see him about that. And I said, Mr. Koch, this isn't the way it's supposed to be. I said, and I said, whether you are or aren't, time will tell. Like Mr. Armstrong said, if you keep the truth, if you hold fast to the Sabbath, the holy days, the gospel, you know, if you maintain the doctrines and do the job, then God will give you the title. And after a number of years, you'll know. And so here we are, you know, a month and a half after his death, and he's trying to take the title. I said, I don't think you should do it this way, especially. And he said, well, nobody else has said anything, and I can't be equal with these other men. And he was starting to get mad. You know, your veins start coming out. And I could see that. And so I just said, well, Mr. Koch, that's fine if that's what you want to do. But I said, wasn't Peter one of 12 apostles? And he kind of looked at me, and, you know, they were. They're all equal. They're all apostles. Why can't somebody be in charge and be equal? And so, well, nobody else agrees. Well, let me call Dr. Hay. He's called Dr. Hay, and Dr. Hay agreed with me. And so he took it out. Now, 6 months later, he took the title anyway himself. But again, taking a title that you aren't given doesn't mean anything at all in my book. And it's interesting because I got removed from the Council of Elders over that one. And every time I'd say something, I actually ended up exactly where I wanted to be. I wanted to be free from the stress. I didn't want to work 24 hours a day. I wanted to have a family and kids. And I ended up teaching college in Texas and doing exactly what I wanted via the dissent. So from my standpoint, I ended up where I wanted to be. At the same time, it was disillusioning and hard to watch the church go through what it was going through. And how much do you say? What do you do? Until Mr. Koch died, I really didn't say a whole lot, although I did pray and ask God. I said, God, if someone calls me directly to ask me, if you send them to me, I'll answer questions for them. But publicly, I wasn't going to do anything. And privately, I told Mr. Koch every time he did something foolish, at least from my standpoint spiritually. And my wife used to hate the calls. Sometimes I'd get at 11 o'clock at night, Mr. Koch, his secretary would ring, Michelle said, what did you say this time? But there were things that he did that you all know, obviously, were wrong. So from my standpoint, I did the job that I promised I would do from his behalf. And so, he was ordered not to bring his staff up with it. He was ordered to, you know, keep using the book list to hold the doctors. I mean, the promises were there. And you may ask, well, why didn't Mr. Armstrong write those down legally and have them signed so that we could have a document to stand up and make the church stay? Well, that was a good question. Because from my standpoint, you know, you think, why would the church, you know, why would God want the church to do what it did? And then I remember opening my Bible just randomly kind of and going into ending up with in Kings and reading where Rehoboam was getting ready to attack Jeroboam. And God said, don't do it. This is of me. And so I thought, you know, something is happening here. God is sorting out the church. And you know, you can jump up and down all you want and try to grab the wheat and the chaff and stick it all back. No, God, you can't take these people out. Well, a lot of those people needed to be out. A lot of people never had God's Spirit, didn't really believe. They sat in a chair there, not because they wanted to, because they had to. And so God was sifting in His way and, again, purifying the bride. And I look at that, and I ask Mr. Armstrong, how do we purify the bride more? We're going to go back to double services every holy day, like when I was a kid. You know, you spent 8 hours in services and 2 hours at lunch, and that was about it. It seemed like they went on forever. And didn't necessarily produce a lot more spirituality. It did teach you patience and faith, that they would quit eventually. But it was, for all of us who grew up in the church in those early years in the 50s and 60s, there were some very, very long sermons. So I just wonder, how do you do this? And I look at it, and and always looking in hindsight at what God has done is exciting. Because if I was going to get married, I did, and I married someone who had dated all sorts of people, and she said yes when I asked her, I wouldn't want to go to an island where there are only women. They'd never seen a man. Hey, you go there, of course they're in love with you. You're the only man there. Is that a pure bride? Is that someone who really loves you? How do you know when she meets the next guy that seems to be better than you that she won't run off with him? And for us spiritually, most of us, you know, came to the church, we're called by God, we see this, it seems true. There wasn't anything offered to us different. Now all of a sudden we're being told that everybody's a Christian. It's okay if you're a Catholic, it's okay if you're a Methodist, okay if you're a Baptist, Episcopalian, Anglican, anything. As long as you're reasonably good with your religion, everything's wonderful. And Mike, as I came down to Big Sandy, was talking about the same thing and how, you know, he said to preach Christ, you know, and say Christ's name and believe the typical Protestant lines. I said, Mike, so what about all the people that are Buddhists? I said, I know Buddhists that are good people, better than a lot of Christians I know. And, oh, that's okay. He says, they'll get in the kingdom. I said, well, they can't. They don't know Christ. Well, God knows how they would have reacted had they heard Christ's name. I said, Mike, you don't believe in the resurrection anymore, do you? Oh, no. He doesn't believe in the resurrection. I said, you're nuts. That's not the Bible. So what book are you reading? Well, I knew what he was reading. A bunch of junk from Azusa Pacific. And I challenged him on all of them. There's no answer you can give for that. And yet, but think about it. What does the Bible talk about? Those who have not committed fornication with the world? You've been offered everything. You can be a Buddhist, you can be a Shinto, a Hindu, a Baptist, you can be anything, you can be a Muslim, whatever. As long as you're good with what you do, God would know how you would react to it, and therefore you get in. That is nonsense. But that has been offered all the world's religious prostitution you can have. And what have each of you had to say? I want Christ. Christ is who I want to marry. I want to be part of God's family. And so you have actually been purified in that sense. Not still taking place. You're still going on. We're not dead yet. So once you die, it's over. You've made your mark. So we're still growing that way. But how better way to take a people who are so taught government, over-taught government, in my opinion, from the standpoint of how it was administered. A lot of people don't realize Mr. Armstrong was not nearly the hierarchical administrator that people paint him out to be. He was definitely in charge, and if he came with wrong doctrine or came in a wrong attitude, you definitely knew he was in charge. And people talk about how strong he was that way, but they don't know the human side of him. At the same time, he would give you a job and let you do it. He didn't ride you. He didn't, basically once in a while he'd ask, well, how's it going? Is it set up? You know, and you'd answer and say everything's fine and go on. But there wasn't this demand for straight loyalty up. He did demand loyalty to God, no question about that, which all of us should. I don't want any personal loyalty. I like having friends, I enjoy friends, and I love people. But loyalty to God, that's where it's at. Loyalty to God, loyalty to Christ. And that's what Mr. Armstrong demanded. So many others seem to take that one step further down to the human level that you have to have loyalty to me, or else you're not loyal to God. And yes, that's true to an extent, as we esteem each other better than ourselves, and as each of us can teach, and there is help, and the ministry is there to serve spiritually and guide. At the same time, you prove everything against the Bible. And Mr. Armstrong always said, don't believe me, believe your Bible. And that was constant. And even when he had certain ideas that were put in his head, it's funny, when I look at him, when I look at the doctrines, I look at things that are right and wrong, and where he had to change. The things that he came to, that God led him to, I can hardly find anything at all anywhere that disagrees. But there are some things that people brought to him that kind of talked him into. One of the best examples of that was for a short period of time. Someone had come to him and said, "Mr. Larson, look at this, and Zechariah, look at this, Joshua and Zerubbabel. You know, that you built the church, and Ted's there, and the filthy garments, and this is Ted, and he's going to come back." Mr. Larson wanted his son to come back. And that's something natural for a father, to want his son who's done something wrong. And he prayed for his father, for his son every night. And so he kind of bought into that. And he was up there preaching that for a few months. And it kind of gnawed on me, because I went through and read the chapter, and I didn't see it that way. And yet the person who brought it to him made a lot of points off it, which people were wont to do back then. And so finally one day he came, "Isn't it exciting? Ted's going to come back and do all this. Aaron, what do you think of this?" I said, "Really, you really want to know?" He realized that I wasn't getting real excited. And I said, "Well," he said, "Yeah, I do." I said, "Well, Mr. Armstrong," I said, "I would like to see people repent and come back as well. But," I said, "have you read that whole chapter?" I said, "There's things that don't agree with this." And he's kind of getting irritated and, "Oh, okay, what do you mean?" I said, "Mr. Armstrong, do you mind if we just read the chapter?" "Okay." So we started reading through it. And as you go down through the verses, there's things that just don't fit. And he could tell he didn't want to see it. But with him, it was a matter of, if the Bible disagrees with it, that's it. It's over. The last time he ever preached on that, or even said anything about it. Because he realized it didn't agree with Scripture. And so, as hard as it was for him, and like I told you, I didn't mean that someone wasn't going to repent and come back. It just meant that that particular scripture wasn't a prophecy about coming back or that. And so, but if that was his, even for him, when it was a personal thing, if the Bible disagreed, that's it. You don't fall in love with your own pet doctrines. And there were times when people would bring things to him and twist them a certain way that he would kind of fall into it, sadly. But all of us do. When someone says something you want to hear, you tend not to want to believe it. And some of our problems in the 70s, and unfortunately a lot of these things are millstones that hang around the necks of many people. And I pray that I don't have any millstones or that I've shed any that I did. But there were people that would bring things to him and lie. And one time a person got to Mr. Armstrong and told him that he was spending a lot more money on his travels than Mr. Armstrong wanted to. Mr. Armstrong always wanted to make sure that his part of the travels, even though income was $200 million, he wanted to make sure that the travels that he did weren't more than $1 million. We were traveling an awful lot, and that doesn't go a long ways, but that's something that he just didn't want to do. Well, he was always told that, "You're fine, we're not," he didn't look at the bills and things, so he really didn't know what all was being spent. But one of the accountants staff people managed to somehow, and I'm not sure how, if he ran into him walking or whatever, but told him he was spending a lot more than that. Mr. Armstrong got really mad and called Stan Rader at him. And the way that it worked in this case was Stan would go in, find out, he knew he was mad, knew what it was about, and he was already prepared. So he pulls out a computer printout. Some of you in here probably work with computers, but the computer printout was Cost Center 5610, which is Herbert W. Armstrong. And it was under $1 million. And he pulled it out, showed Mr. Armstrong, "Well, here's your cost center. See, there's your name at the top, here's the numbers, and here's the bottom line, and see, you're not spending that much." And so Mr. Armstrong, "Oh, okay." And then along with that, he would say, "Now that person that was here, he wasn't a CPA, he wasn't that, he saw something, he really didn't know how this all works. And therefore, he's really a good person, and don't get mad at him or anything, because he was trying to do what was right, and I'm sure he's dedicated and whatever, but he just doesn't understand." Well, now Mr. Armstrong would have been smart to have gone a little farther into that himself, but it was what he wanted, and he had no reason to think he was being lied to, and so that was it. Now, all Stan Rader had to do was make sure that person never got in there again, because, see, there were five other cost centers. So when you break it down and spread the bucks, and you only get one set, and you get the set that you want shown, and it's the set you want to believe, and you don't know there's anything else, you go on. And again, with him, he was doing the work, he was writing, he was, that's all he did. In fact, Princess Lillian, King Leopold's wife, when I was his aide, we went in to see her after King Leopold died. And she looked over at me, we were sitting on the couch talking. She looked over and says, "Aaron, where'd you go on vacation last year?" I said, "Nowhere." "Where'd you go the year before?" "Well, nowhere." She looks at Mr. Armstrong and looks back at me. "Aaron, have you ever had a vacation?" I said, "Well, no." "Mr. Armstrong, you can't do this to him." Mr. Armstrong says, "Well, he's like me. His life's his work." I said, "Yeah, not by choice." But that was the way it was. Because that was his whole focus. his whole life. I mean, like you said, after his heart attack, he says, I'm here for the people. God brought me back to put things on track, to get things going again. And he said, I didn't enjoy life. Nothing tastes good. Nothing feels good. I mean, really, he was, you know, blind in one eye. He could hardly hear. And basically, when he got there to speak, God would give him the spirit, and he would just get dynamic. Back to this Princess or General Rana's wife, who she invited us to have lunch at her house. We did that day in Nepal, and he had a mild heart attack there. Took oxygen and was really weak. And she's saying, "We got to cancel the meeting with the Parliament tonight. You know, he could die." And I said, "No, leave it alone. He'll be fine." And she couldn't believe it. So I just said, we left and went back to the hotel. And it was more an angina attack than an actual heart attack, just the oxygen, the altitude problem. So we go down to have the meeting that night, and you know, I walk Mr. Armstrong in. He stops in the hallway, and they can see out the door that he's out there taking oxygen halfway down the hall. Walks in a little farther, takes a little more oxygen, comes in, sits down, kind of playing with his food, and you know, eating a couple bites. Not doing it. Mrs. Rana, I'm sitting at her table. She's saying, he shouldn't be out there. He's not going to do anything. This is ridiculous. I said, just wait. And then all of a sudden, he stands up with a microphone there, starts pounding his table, and just starts going on about the kingdom and what's coming and peace. And Mrs. Rana, first thing, after about a minute into this, she leans over to me and says, you know, that's not him talking. That's God talking. That man's not strong enough to do that. But it happened all the time. You know, he was at his best when God was doing that for him. And he'd be drained when it was over. But yet I saw it time and time again, because he just was not capable physically of doing some of those things. And to see those miracles, that's why for me to deny what I've seen and heard would be like, you know, Peter and them after they're beaten, to say, we can't save anything what we've seen and heard. You can beat us all you want, but this is what happened. And so to see those things and the fact that God did lead him in those areas, in spite of these other problems that were there. And the key was to try to, and I saw my job, and I'll tell you, the only saving grace with me in trying to do my job, there were a couple things. One is I went through 12 years of imperial, which meant that I've been taught never to say no. So if you're asked to do something, you did it, whether you could or not. The other thing was that I was in the airplane for 7 years as steward, with no functional authority, no line authority, no anything. And I watched people say things to him. And the decisions made off of what they said were wonderful. And I would have agreed, and I'd have probably done the same thing. The only problem is, I also went back home and found out that the information that he was given, which created that decision, was wrong. They were lies, and I saw people hurt. I mean, I saw the bodies of people, basically, who paid the price for those lies and or technical truths. Sometimes they were true, but only partially true. You know, we had a president that was real good at that. You have a prime minister that's good at that, too, I think. But, in fact, most politicians that are any good are very good at that. But the thing is he believed a lot of this, whether he should have or not. Again, it's another question. But then again, were those things done because God knew what he was doing, that he would bring us to this point where we are today? You have to leave it in God's hands, or else, you know, without the faith that God and Christ know what they're doing, you do get upset. And I got upset. But after 7 years of watching a lot of this, I promised myself that I would never lie to him. I would give him all the facts, and regardless of the cost, because yes, if you told him things you didn't want to hear, you'd get upset sometimes. But I figured that's what your job is. And so it was interesting, because during that time, Michelle and I went through an awful lot, and people always wonder why she's still with me. It's because she's better than I am. But it was interesting, because to be told that by people, when you finally have had enough, and during the receivership after his heart attack, I was one of the people going back and forth delivering messages from Tucson when he moved there. And he would say things that he wanted done, and I would tell Mr. Rader and others what he wanted, and they would go out and say things that were the opposite. Mr. Armstrong wants you to do this. And I said, that's not what Mr. Armstrong wanted. So it became a problem, and I got removed from the airplane by them and sent back to school for accounting and law, which I never finished law school or got really into that, but I did do enough accounting classes to, if I wanted to take a CPA exam, I could have. Didn't really enjoy it, and missed most of it because I was traveling at the same time. Trying to do an accounting degree when you're gone half of the classes is a challenge, to say the least. But I managed to do it. But they got upset enough with me because, well, what had happened is there were some real problems that came up. My wife had worked up there and had to quit because the women that worked in the office up there were, to say the least, ungodly. But and doing things that just weren't fitting. And there were things that the crew on the airplane who were at the church had to hold up to because they represented the church. in a sense, they worked for us. And there were things done that were wrong, and my wife had to quit. And she asked me, should I quit? And if I do, there'll be no one to cover for you. And I said, well, that's fine. Because her comment was either quit the church or quit the job. And I said, well, quit the job. And she did, and so she got a real good job out where we lived. And the guy changed the Christmas bonuses for her because she found it didn't bring in Christmas, so the whole office had to wait to get their bonuses and things. So things like that, it was wonderful for her. But she had seen how they operated and understood that. And so I'd gone in finally and said some things. And I was literally told, two of the people up there called me in, they said, we know what you know. We know what you're upset about. Well, if you say this, we're going to say this. We know what you're going to say. You're going to tell the truth. We're going to lie. There were six of us on that trip. We're all going to say the same thing. We're going to say what Mr. Armstrong wants to hear. And we'll destroy you. You see, you get thrown out of the church. We'll destroy you, your family, and everything you stand for. Be told that straight up. And then go through the actual incidents and say how they're going to twist them. And to think, well, do you want to pay that price? And it was funny. I'd prayed earlier about it. I said, God, if you want Mr. Armstrong to know what's going on, have him ask me. If he asks me directly, I'll tell him. So when they did this to me, I said, well, I'm not planning on saying that because I wasn't. Unless he asked, I wasn't going to. Well, a couple weeks after that, they pulled me off the plane altogether from flying and had me go to school full-time, which I already was going full-time, but now they basically use the excuse you really need to be home to take the classes. Usually taking the classes does help you learn something, but you can do it without being there, too. So they pulled me off the airplane. The next trip came up. Mr. Armstrong got on the plane. He looked around, and I wasn't there. The one thing he didn't do is take people off of Mr. Armstrong's staff that he had put on there. So they asked, where's Aaron? I had written a letter to Mr. Armstrong just wishing him well on the trip. I just said, I understand you want me to go back to school to help the church and do these things. And I wish you well on your campaign in the Philippines. And if you need me, you know, these degrees don't mean anything to me. But if you want me to do them, I'll do them. If you don't, then, you know, call me and I'll be back and help you. But he read the letter and he got really upset from what I understand from the crew member that they put on there who had given him the letter. And he folded it and stuck it in his pocket, which he always did. It was interesting because the other people on the plane saw him, so I was upset. And their thought was that I'd said all the things that I was going to say. So all of a sudden, he started getting a barrage of telexes. He landed and he had messages from them, started, again, saying all the things I hadn't said. So he called up, they landed in Hawaii, he called me and said, get over here immediately. Flew to Hawaii on the next flight. And he asked the questions exactly the way I'd prayed them. And I thought, boy, do I want to? And I thought of Gideon. Gideon got two chances. He could ask for the fleece wet and he could ask for it dry. And I thought, you know, can I get out of this somehow? Should I answer? All these questions probably went quickly through my head, but it seemed like an eternity before I answered him. And I said, no, I prayed it, I'll tell him. So I did. And then he asked another question. I answered that one. We did a few questions. And he got upset. And he got upset for one thing because he didn't want me to go back to school. And even though they had said he wanted me to do this, he didn't. So I got fired for that. But then he said, well, you didn't know any better, so I got rehired, etc. So each day of the trip, though, the same thing would happen. He'd get more telexes with more garbage. He'd also at the time say, well, you know, I used my first wife, Loma, as my advisor, so I want to bring my second wife in now, and you can tell the same things you told me to her. Well, I knew she was on the other side. He didn't. So I had to say these same things in front of her, knowing that everything was going right back. And so the character assassination began. And the charges began, and everything they promised, they delivered. Both barrels, as they say. And so I went through 31 days on one trip where I got fired 7 times and thrown out of the church 3 times. It was not fun. But at the same time, it was, you're telling the truth. And all of you who are second generation Christians know that your parents told you if you tell the truth and you do what's right, that everything's going to go wonderful. I'm telling the truth, and I'm doing what's right, and I'm getting thrown out of the church and fired, and it does not compute. It doesn't read the way my parents told me. And then you read the scriptures and find out it only goes well when Christ, you know, the joy I leave with you that Christ meant was in the future, in the millennium, being part of the God family, not necessarily on earth in some of the petty political things that happened to us. And so, in our quest to find out, you know, what we're supposed to do and answer our questions, try and be honest, we learned this. Mr. Armstrong called me in one day about 2 weeks into the trip, and he said, did anybody see you come in here? I said, no. He said, well, sneak out the back, because he says, they're trying to kill me. He says, last night they kept me up at 2 o'clock in the morning screaming at me, and they want me to die so they can say who's going to be in charge. And he says, you're not on the approved list of people I can talk to. And I said, well, I know that. And they did all sorts of things, wrote letters and got people to say things. I was sad to see what they got some people that I considered friends and fellow Christians to say and do. But with enough stress, enough duress, some people fold and say things and do things. Also, they had people on the trip that would listen outside the door. And Mr. Armstrong had no hearing aids at the time. And so I knew they were listening. And he would start telling me private things about himself that you know, with some incidents, and I'd be going, please don't say this, please don't say this. I knew, I already knew the problem. And I quoted him word for word. How come you told anybody what I said? I didn't tell anybody. You must have told. I said, I didn't tell anybody. Yes, you did. Look at this. And I said, you know, and then I'd say, Mr. Rochelle, they're out listening at the door. So, you know, what? They're listening at the door. Of course, and he'd get up and start waddling over the door and open it. By that time, they'd been, you know, halfway down the hall and inside another room. And it wasn't until 30 days into the trip that he found out they really were listening at the door. And I was getting butchered every day, pretty much, because it was so awkward. And yet you know, from my standpoint, life had always been fairly easy. Education was fairly easy. I basically done the things that I was supposed to do, and had a good mind and a good memory. And so from my standpoint, you know, as long as you tell the truth, you do what happened, you'll be fine. And so the lesson for me was, except that God, you know, it doesn't make a difference if you're Einstein, who you are. I don't care how smart you are, how good your memory is, how loyal, faithful, all the things. If Satan wants you and God doesn't help you, it's over. And so the reliance that I learned personally on God at that time, it deflated my own vanity and ego from the standpoint of being intelligent. Intelligence doesn't mean anything at all. Because if people are willing to lie, how do you prove you didn't say something? You know, three people, five people, or in this case, six people say, you said this. And they told me when they said it. You know, the Bible says the mouth of two witnesses. We got six. We'll say what we want to say. And you're one. How do you prove you didn't say something? How do you prove you didn't do something? You can't. Unless God helps you through it, that's it. The only saving thing I had of Mr. Armstrong was to say, you know, Aaron, I know your attitude's right. But where there's smoke, there's fire. And I had learned that there didn't have to be any fire. Didn't have to be anything. Kind of like the old legal saying, if you throw enough mud, something sticks. And that's true. And Mr. Armstrong knew my attitude was right, but at the same time, he said, why aren't people writing good things about you? And Mr. Armstrong, I've flown with you 7 years. Have you ever got a telex about me, good or bad? Well, no. I said, do you expect somebody, my friend, to wake up and say, you know, today would be a good day to write Mr. Armstrong and tell him how wonderful Aaron Dean is. And let me see, where is he? Oh, he's in the Manila Hotel in the Philippines. Let me see, that telex number, I know that. None of you know how to, I wouldn't have known if I wasn't flying how to get a hold of him. I said, Mr. Armstrong, this is all being solicited. Well, I guess so. And I said, Mr. Armstrong, I said, if they're trying to kill you, it's hurting you, let me go home. I'll go home. So I don't want you to suffer any damage. If it'll be better for you for me to leave, let me leave. But I said, I don't want you to think I'm leaving because they're telling the truth, because they're lying. So what I've told you is the truth. He said, well, no good to stay. Well, that started it. And they kept going and going. And they really wanted me out of the picture because I knew too much, obviously. We finished the trip and came home. And I got home to the house about 3:15 in the afternoon. And the phone rings 15 minutes later. Mr. Armstrong. He said, leave town immediately. Your life's been threatened. So I did. Got in the car. Put it on the refrigerator. My wife said, I'm home. But I've got to leave. Don't know when I'll see you. Didn't tell her someone was trying to kill me. Didn't think that would make her feel better. So I left. Called her later that night and kind of told her what was going on. And for a month, I spent jumping motels, running around looking over my shoulder and not telling anybody where I was. Except my wife and Mr. Armstrong wanted to know where I was, so I'd always call and tell him the phone number of the hotel I stayed at the previous night because I knew that people would go through his pockets at night and find out where I was anyway. And which they did because they told him that Aaron's telling everybody where he is and saying things. And Mr. Armstrong called when I called the next day. He said, how come you're telling everybody? I said, I'm not. And he said, well, yes, they told me the numbers. And I said, Mr. Armstrong, I've never given you a number of a place I was staying at. He said, well, why? I said, because you put it in your pocket and they go through your pocket tonight. Oh. Well, that's smart. But it was interesting because during that time, Mr. Armstrong set up the Council of Elders. and he set up the Council of Elders secretly. He'd go out for drives like he would do occasionally, and he'd meet, he set up Mr. Knapp, who was treasurer, and he had him come, and they rented a hotel room, and they set it up so that legally, that if anything happened to him, and he were to die, that the 12 ministers would decide who would be in charge. Well, when that happened, then pretty much the wind came out of the sails of those who would want to be in charge, because they knew at that point in time that if he died and they were to say this, here's the documentation signed by him that says no. So at that time he called me to come back and fly for him, and I actually thought my career, and I hoped it was, I didn't ask to fly. I didn't really want to I was supposed to go out as a trainee, as a minister in the field, and I was supposed to go to Salt Lake City. It was on graduation day at brunch, the formal brunch, that they paged me, and which meant that I was in trouble, because nobody pays anybody in a formal brunch, especially students. And so I didn't know what I'd done. But at the same time, I went and answered the phone to Mr. Armstrong. And, hello, sir. He said, do you know who this is? I said, yes, sir. And I felt like asking, do you know who this is? You know, why do you want me? And I said, yes, sir, what can I do? He said, well, I want you to fly with me on the G2. And I said, well, I'm supposed to go to Salt Lake City. I'm supposed to leave Sunday to go up there as a trainee. He said, well, they'll understand. And so I said, well, when are you leaving? He said, Monday morning at 8. So Monday morning at 8 o'clock, I took off on my first flight on the airplane. I was supposed to be training my brother who had flown before me. And Sunday, I was out the plane working, and he was going to go on the flight, and I'd be trained and about up to speed. On Sunday night at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, Captain Black calls and says, you know how to do this. It's not a problem. Your brother's not flying. You're doing it by yourself. So I took my first flight with no training, by myself in the airplane, where if you make a mistake, you can't just step out to the store and get something. So it was exciting. And I often said I've never had a job description. I've never had a job. I knew what I was doing. But a little bit of faith, I guess you can do whatever. So I started flying with him at that point. And all the jobs I had when I became his aide, he asked me three different times over a period of 3 weeks to be his aide. And I turned him down each time because, the first time I told him, I've seen the job. It can't be done. I don't want it. And so he let me go. And the third time he ordered me to do it. I said, if you're going to order me to do it, fine. I'll do it. Because I said, if God makes you do something, he helps you. If you choose to do something, he doesn't. And unfortunately for those on the airplane, because in the 70s, the airplane was out of the country about 300 days a year, which wasn't too good on marriages. And Michelle and I are the only people I know that kept their marriage together during that, because we didn't want the job. We didn't try to do it. We didn't ask for it. And we did the one thing we could do, which was not have children, because I didn't want to be an absentee father. And if you're gone 300 days a year, it's not that hard not to have children. So it wasn't too hard in the first 7 years. The last five were a little more difficult. We traveled together, and my wife, on her first trip, and she didn't ask to fly either. And I didn't ask for her to fly. It was interesting that I went to Mr. Armstrong's house one day, and Bob Fay was there at the time. Actually, he was his aide for about 9 months, and he had talked to Mr. Armstrong. I had no idea, because his comment to me when he came in, he was gung-ho, let's go through the work, let's visit every church, let's do this. And Aaron, what do you think of us going all these places? And I said, well, I've already missed half my marriage, so not that exciting for me. But what had happened, he talked to Mr. Armstrong about putting Michelle on a stewardess. I had no idea about this. Mr. Armstrong called me up to his house and said, what do you think of the new decision? I said, well, fine. Well, I could say I had no idea what he's talking about. And he said, well, I don't know if it's going to work out. And I said, well, I guess it will. He said, well, I don't know if your wife can do this. And then that's the first inkling I had that we're talking about my wife. And then I found out that she was going to be on the plane. And it was just a test run. And then she gets on the plane, and the first thing she just told Mr. Armstrong, well, you know, this is just a test. You may not be on here very long. You just got to see if it works. And she didn't know if she wanted to or not, because it's one of those things where you, the first trip we took was New Zealand. The first day was 27 hours. After the first couple of days, she says, this is work. And I said, well, it always has been. It's not so romantic going to all these places and flying and hotels, but this all work. So she wanted to quit. And I said, you tell him I'm not. She wouldn't, so we didn't. So the last 5 years we flew together, and we're both tied down. And but we made sure we didn't have any children during that time, even though we wanted children. And there are a lot of people in the church that come, oh, we're praying for your wife so that she won't be barren, that you can have children. And we were praying that we wouldn't have kids, and we were hoping God would hear us and not them. And he did, until after Mr. Armstrong died, thankfully, because we have two children now. But it was a challenge to
be there and to do the things that he wanted done. If you don't ask for something, God helps you. So when all these things are coming down then, and Mr. Armstrong's trying to decide who to put in charge, Mr. Dukach is there, and he made all the promises. Mr. Dukach promised all the things he was supposed to promise. He said all the things he needed to say to be in charge, including, I don't want to be in charge, which I told Mr. Armstrong, I said, it's unfortunate that the right answer is always the right answer when you're, whether you're a good person or a bad person. Someone says, I want to be in charge, give me the job. Are you going to get it? Absolutely not. If you really don't want the job, say, I don't want the job. It's the right answer. And so all, you know, a little kid, same thing. Did you break that window? If you do, I'm going to, you know, beat you. Well, the kid's right answer is no, I didn't. Because you say no, and you did it, you did it, you're getting spanked. If you say you didn't do it, get caught, you get spanked. If you say you didn't do it, don't get caught, you don't get spanked. So, I mean, it's only one right answer. So that's kind of where the situation we're in. And Mr. Dukach said all the right answers. At the same time, when Mr. Armstrong finally did die, Mr. Dukach began breaking promises. I was asked to lie from the pulpit the first week after Mr. Armstrong died. I said, Mr. Dukach, I'm not lying for you. I'm lying for anybody. I said, you know, this is not the way it happened. He asked me to go up the pulpit and say how Mr. Armstrong had trained him for all these years to do the job and how he knew he was the one. I said, Mr. Dukach, that's not true. You know that. He changed his mind several times. What really irritated Mr. Dukach is Mr. Armstrong tried to give me the job 3 weeks before he died. And he walked downstairs and said, Aaron, you're the pastor general. I said, what? He said, you're the new pastor general. I said, did God tell you that? No. I said, why are you trying to kill me? I said, look in the Bible. Look at all the leaders that got appointed. I said, they went through hell. The ones he didn't appoint were miserable. I mean, it's not a job you want. I said, you know, I said, I still want a family. I don't want to, I mean, I'll still help. I'll do what I need to. And that's when he made me promise to be Mr. Dukach's aide. And that's when he told Mr. Dukach to promise all the things that he was supposed to do and didn't do. And so, it started the minute Mr. Armstrong died. Things started changing. Everything in my office was that morning was stripped out of my desk and out of his. Sadly, because there was nothing I was doing. There was no reason to think I would do anything other than keep serving. And the papers that Mr. Armstrong had, I was the only one who knew which ones were like letters he'd written, which were sent, which weren't sent, anything that might be a legal problem. I was the only one that could sort out. Now they'd scrambled everything all over. All my files they'd taken. Letters to ministers and things. Some of those ended up on the internet later, were in those files, although I never had them after that, so I know I didn't send them out. Some people accused me of sending letters out, and I never did, but because I didn't have them, and wouldn't have anyway. But it was interesting to see that happen. My secretary and Brenda Yale and Julie Stocker called up the morning after he died, and they were crying. He said, they're treating us like criminals. Did we do something wrong? I said, no. I said, what do we do? I said, just get a cup of coffee, go out, leave. I said, no, the king is dead, long live the king. That's kind of how they treat it. So I said, don't worry about it. I said, God's doing something, and we'll all find out what it is. And so that happened, and it changed. And, you know, when he didn't become the apostle right away, I got moved off the council. And others came to me and said, well, in fact, it was funny because some of the people that the other evangelists, I met a couple of them in the hallway who told me, why didn't that PGR go out about the apostle? And I said, well, I went and said something, didn't you? And they said, oh, no, well, we didn't like it, but we didn't say anything. And I said, well, you should have. And if that's okay, well, now we know why you're not on the council anymore. But that's okay, we're still on the council, we'll tell him, we'll keep him in line. So they didn't, and obviously. But that was one of the things. And then he did several things, and I found out I wasn't vice president of the foundation from a student in the elevator, which was kind of cute. So I got back in the elevator, went right back up, walked into Mr. Dukach's office. I said, oh, Mr. Dukach, I understand I'm not vice president of the foundation anymore. Oh, well, I guess I should have told you. I said, Mr. Dukach, I don't care. So these titles don't mean anything. Never have them. I got a string of cards. I've been everything you can possibly be. Almost like the detective movies for the guys with a card for everything. I mean, I had cards. I was a PT representative. I was a master college representative. I was vice president. I was executive aide. I was, basically, Mr. Dukach and I would joke about, what are you supposed to be today? Because I was going in with him to meet a world leader, I couldn't be some kind of a low person. I had to be a higher person. If I had to be this, then if I want to take photographs, I need to be a press person. So I'd take my press cards, and I'd be that. So, he knew all these things. It wasn't anything that was there, but titles don't mean anything. That was kind of cute to joke with him. But I thought, Scott, I said, you cannot make protocol decisions like this. I said, in the church, you can treat people like you want. But I said, I think you owe it to me to tell me, and then I don't hear this from a student in an elevator. He just hung his head because he knew it. I was right. time you do something like that, I said, you know, you cannot afford to do this diplomatically. He brought all his staff up, but Mr. Armstrong made a promise not to. Well, where did all these problems come from? Mike Lazell, Joe Jr., and all these people he brought up. And so Mr. Armstrong warned him, and he said, those people have caused your problem. They're not to come up. And they did. And so he made them aides along with me, and I had no problem. I said, fine, if you want to do that, fine. But I said, don't go see a world leader with four people in their 30s that are just playing up to you, because you look terrible. So there were times Mr. Armstrong said, Aaron, should you go in? I said, well, Mr. Armstrong, you know, you can't hear, you can't see. I said, most of the people have someone who takes notes. So I can go in there and just be a note taker for you. And that way you'll know what's going on. And you know, a lot of times the nurse didn't go in even though he had his heart problem. So I mean, he was very concerned with that. Well, Mr. Kacha dragged all these people in, and it would look terrible. And in their circles, you know, everybody there had to have a reason to be there. And when you bring them in, you're saying they're equal, and it doesn't work in today's society that way. And so I said, you do these things, you'll look like a fool. Well, he quit visiting world leaders. He never did that anyway. And so it really didn't become a problem per se. It did a little few times when dignitaries visited the campus. But it was sad. And you know, he just didn't understand it, didn't want to. And unfortunately, he needed those people telling him that he was doing good or whatever. But he wouldn't listen. Mr. DeKotch, every time you make a change, he let others make a lot of changes. He didn't really make any changes. He admitted to me the last few months of his life when I went and talked to him when he came down to Texas that he couldn't prove a single change he allowed in the church. And I said, you do not have the right to put something in the church. I said, Mr. Armstrong, you're saying they wouldn't bring anything untrue. I said, what about this? Did they tell you that 90% of the church and the ministry was going along with this? Oh, yes. This isn't true? No. I said, they lied to you. I said, what about this? What about this? What about this? When push came to shove, and Mr. Armstrong had to make a tough decision when he put his son out. He said, I can't let it go on. He said, look at Eli's son. Look at this. I said, wrong is wrong. Mr. DeKotch let his children do something. When it came time to die and pass it on, he made it a family business. Changed the documentation so all the assets belonged to the Koch family, basically. Not that they could just sell them and keep the money, but they could use everything and control everything. And so he set those things up. And he set them up at a time which is fascinating to me, because Mr. Rader had a contract because of the things Mr. Armstrong had thought he'd done before, and it was supposed to expire in 1987. Mr. Armstrong actually hoped to live to stop the contract. I tried to convince him to stop it anyway, and he said, no, we'll be honorable. If we sign something, we'll honor it, even though we don't should owe it. But he ordered Mr. Koch, when that contract's done, it's over. In 1987, when the contract came due, it was renewed for 7 years. And it's interesting, because the same time it was renewed, it's about the same time the documentation was all shifted around legally with the corporate souls and things. You know, whether it's tied together or not, it's kind of interesting. It was, but unfortunately, those things happen. But what did God intend for them? You know, why did he do this? Why did everything we worked for and build up and live for, you know, get taken away in a sense? If I look back and look at myself, even what I did in my own mind, and when someone asks, what are you? What do you stand for? What, you know, what is this about? Well, you'd show them the college. You'd see the students. You'd show them the plane. You'd show them all these physical things. You know, this is what we stand for. And we did. It was beautiful. The millennium, and it was a millennial setting, and you know, all of you have seen Brick of Wood, whether you've seen Pasadena or not, knew it. Beautiful campus. But in reality, what is the kingdom of God? It's not physical things. It's spiritual. When someone asks you, what is God about now? Well, look at me. My life, what I'm trying to do. We are all examples of what God's family is. We are the future kingdom of God, in the sense of part of God's family. keep my promise to Mr. Armstrong to help purify the bride means that I have to be willing to answer questions and help people. I don't even ask people where they go when they ask questions to me or write me or email. Oftentimes people volunteer it. Sometimes because of the questions they ask, you can tell where they are, because they often ask questions about usually their own leadership and is something that they said true or untrue. You know, whether they were Mr. Armstrong's, like one says, a personal confidant, and others that twist their own history. And again, it doesn't mean they're doctrinally off necessarily. I don't have a problem as long as people are doctrinally pure. And again, you know, core doctrines are there. Some people are getting off of core doctrines. There are groups out there that, you know, one group that believes that all humanity will be saved. They've kind of taken the Descartes line in the opposite direction, that Satan is responsible for all sins. Therefore, anytime you sin, it's on Satan's shoulder. Therefore, God saves you. And their take ends up being that the two trees, it says the tree of life is there by the stream at the end. And so therefore, all humanity, except for the 144,000, which is us, that's what they say, the special ones, they get to be spirit beings. Everybody else lives forever physically. That's their final outcome. Now, they've even got more strange than that. I talked to a couple people in their group that wrote me, and I said, well, how do the others become dust and ashes under the feet of the righteous if nobody dies? It doesn't work scripturally, obviously, but people can be taken away. You have to be careful what you hear and what you say and what you believe. You have to check it against your Bible. I always tell people, ask the ministry. Ask in several different groups you want. See what several answers are if you need to make sure. Something sounds funny from what you were taught. Think about it. Make sure it's right. There is a natural. It'd be nice to be comfortable. It'd be nice to know if I just follow this person, I get in the kingdom. Well, if this person is Jesus Christ, you will get in the kingdom. With anybody else, it may or may not. I don't know what Uriah is going to think about David when he was resurrected. Knowing Uriah, he was such a loyalist, though, he'll probably say, well, that was fun. But anytime you're with human beings, they do things that are wrong. And they will dislodge you. And I've seen people get so attached. I remember once, this was in the 70s, there was someone who was such a friend of one of the evangelists who left in the 70s. But the evangelist said in the sermon it was okay to tell a lie. As long as it's a white lie for the right reasons, okay. And I was sitting there afterwards talking to this person and said, that's wrong. Oh, no, that's right. You know, it defended him because he was so close to that person that even though he was saying break one of God's 10 commandments, it's okay. You can't get so close to someone that they can twist scripture and you go with it. It doesn't work. That's not the way God says it. You have to be pure before God. And that's a difficult assignment. And all of us flounder a bit to figure out where to go and what to do. I stay at the college until it closed. A lot of people wanted me to go to other groups. I've been asked to go to almost all the groups at one time or another when they're starting up. I've often felt like David's last wife. You read the story of David. In society today, if you marry the queen, then you've kind of got a claim to the throne. And remember, Adonijah asked for David's last wife, and Solomon said, oh, you want the throne also, huh? So all these people were asking me, and it wasn't so much that they wanted me. I think it's that if I was there as Mr. Armstrong's aide, then that meant they had a legitimate claim to be the mantle successor. Well, there was no mantle passed to a single successor. And Mr. Descartes tried to claim that mantle. Interesting, if you were to take a tour of Mr. Armstrong's home, which they did for about a year, they quit doing it. They wrote a manual like they did for all the buildings. In the manual, it says, this is the chair Mr. Armstrong ordained Mr. Descartes to his job. Two of the staff members, because they called me that night and asked me if he was ordained, they said, Mr. Armstrong ordained Mr. Descartes? No. I said, no. Honestly, he refused to. I said, why? He said, well, they have this in the manual. We asked them, was he ordained? They said, you say exactly what's in that manual. Don't you change one word. I said, well, they're trying to deceive. So I said, semantically, I ordain you to go conquer the world. I mean, you can stretch the word semantically, but in a religious context, they're deliberately trying to deceive. And that's what they put, because they're trying to build a legend. God groups, there's more opportunity for people to grow. We tended to have such a structure that very few people. In Pasadena, you had to be a preaching elder to give the closing prayer. There are so many evangelists and people around. Is it that God wants more of us involved personally? We probably have thousands and thousands of volunteer hours that we've never had in the past. My dad was a deacon, and he'd want to do something, and the pastor would be a nominal, whoever's over the college or whatever, and I've got staff people to do that. I mean, there was nothing to do with the deacon. Is it because God wants us more involved? God really knows what we need. And Christ wants us to be pure before Him. We are a chosen people, as Peter said, peculiar people, chosen generation, called to do something special. We're one nation in His eyes, one people. Yet, we are scattered. And God knows that. Christ knows that. And whether we get back together or not is in His hands. I've been told I didn't believe in the place of safety anymore. And I said, well, we told you that. Well, you're in United. Well, no, that wasn't true. I mean, there are things that you believe, we believe, and I believe, and he, that go around. And I know there are nuances. There are things in different areas where people disagree, but they disagree within different groups as well as outside among groups. Thankfully, we're here at the Holy Days, so we all believe that. You start there at the Sabbath. There are certain things that, and again, there are things that we won't know until Christ comes back and tells us. And He's the one that's going to make our religion pure. He's the one, the Holy Spirit, which leads us. But if we start trying to make up things on our own, and again, there are places that people want to be for various reasons. There are people that want to make the truth fit in their image. And I'm in correspondence with people that feel that the truth ended in the 60s. Others who believe the truth ended in the 70s. Others who believe it ended in the 80s. Others who believe it ended, And when you look at it, you look at their lives, usually there was something in their life. In one case, there's a young man who believes that there should never, ever be a divorce no matter what. Mr. Armstrong, in the 70s, when things went wrong in 74, that everything pre-74 was fine, but Mr. Armstrong was misled. But he had a family problem where his parents were divorced, and it caused him no end of grief. And whether they should have been divorced or not, I'm not here to judge that. And I think there's more divorces than we should have, and various things, so I'm not trying to discuss that. But at the same time, there are causes. And Mr. Armstrong studied that thoroughly. And he didn't get divorced or chink the change because he wanted to get married, because the change was made before he ever even knew his second wife existed from the standpoint of anything emotionally. He had met her when he hired her as a receptionist, a telephone operator 20 years before, but he had never had any contact with her in the years since then. So that wasn't even a thought, yet people will try to say that. But some people get trapped in certain eras, and they think, okay, this is everything's right here and not there. But yet Mr. Armstrong was brought back from the dead to put things back on track, and he didn't change those things, even though we discussed them. And where do you want to draw the line? Well, really, you draw the line where the book is, and you study it. One of the things I tell people is, well, do a study. You want to know about that? Do a full study on it. Get a concordance out. Look at it. Read the scriptures. Because if I tell you do that, are you going to get in the kingdom? It's a joke that's funny. That it kind of illustrates the point. And it's man dies and goes to heaven, which there is no heaven, so it's obviously a Catholic joke. But the guy dies and goes up to heaven, and he sees these two lines, he sees these two signs up there. One says the henpecked husbands whose wives picked on them, and non-henpecked husbands, and long, long row of men, as far as you can see in the one line, and one guy in the other line. And he goes up to him and he says, you're kidding. He says, your wife never, ever told you anything to do? Oh, no, my wife told me to stand here. Well, if you're there because someone told you to stand there, are you getting in? You're there because of what you believe. What you Samuel didn't do a good child rearing job. Unfortunate, but it's true. Enough so that Israel said, give us a king. And God said, they haven't rejected you, Samuel, they rejected me. For some people who seem to need someone between them and Christ right now, I wonder if the same question is, is Christ telling us right now, I want you to look to me. This is the time you look directly to me. Because I haven't appointed someone. Now, there will be a couple more appointments in the future. We know we have two witnesses. I always joke with some of those who say, we have to have one leader. Well, but what do you do with the two witnesses? And maybe one of them will be a leader over the other. I don't know. Maybe they're standing back to back to fend off the bad guy so that they can see them all. But there are two of them. And, of course, there were 12 apostles. And then Paul came along, the 13th, the Gentiles. So there's times that God does things his way. And as comfortable and as good as I felt with Mr. Armstrong there, and I know, Mr. Armstrong did some things wrong. I saw some decisions that should have turned out bad work out okay because God made it work in spite of him. And he knew that he made some bad decisions. But yet, if God doesn't appoint you, then God doesn't bring it back around. And God said, this is the king who will reign over you. He'll take your wives, he'll take your sons, he'll take you. If you read that chapter, it's all take, take, take. And they got Mr. Armstrong's way of give, way of get. What are we to do as kings? We are to give. We're here. We'll be kings when these days are fulfilled. Revelation 5, we'll be kings and priests. Revelation 20, you'll reign 1,000 years with him. That's your job. You're not going to call and ask for a videotape or ask somebody else. You're going to be running and ruling. And you have to be studying and learning it now. Being a king takes a lot of training. It takes a lot of humility. Probably the biggest thing we lack is humility. For all of us, the higher up ladder you go, the less of it there seems to be. Since I'm up there, I'm tired of myself because I know and I see it. I see it in meetings and things, and we all try, and I respect those that stand up for what they believe and say what they think. And I respect them more if they're willing to listen and take advice if there's something different. Does anybody have a car with a horn like that? They either need to steal it or turn it off. But when you look at those things, you see what happens. You see how lives are affected. Somebody's going to go turn it off. Probably a deer ran into it or something. Somebody got there. Or that the thief finally figured out how to turn it off. But it's interesting in dealing with different kings and leaders and having met so much royalty and how few of them do anything right. But it's fascinating to me to see some of the ones that do things right. And it's interesting when you see a Buddhist king and queen, like Queen Sirikit, King Phumifol of Thailand. And I use them for examples a lot because in them I see so many of the qualities that God says that sometimes the children of the world are wiser than children of light. They do things. And when we were visiting in Thailand and watching the king had heartworms, almost died because of the things he did with the hill people, getting down the dirt and working with them. And so the queen started going out. But we went with Mr. Armstrong. A lot of you, if you got the old envoy in like 85 or 84, had the picture of him up there on the hillside, Burma. One of those fascinating days of my wife and my life, in the sense that the queen had. Well, the reason we asked to go up there actually was because she asked the king, what should I do with Mr. Armstrong when he's here? He said, well, take her up to see the project that he started back in 74 in Angkor. She said, but he's really old like that. I'll just ask him if he wants to do it or can. Tell him, and if he doesn't, fine. So she asked him, and he said yes. She told him it was going to be a tough jaunt because we had to take a plane up to Chiang Mai, a helicopter from Chiang Mai up to Angkor, and then a jeep around these steep winding roads up into the thing and walk a little bit. And he was 90 years old, and it would be tough, and it was tough. And so, but he wanted to do it. And of course, you know about the story of the baby, because the baby had been born, the mother had died, and there was no one could nurse it, and it had already been without food, almost dehydrated. And Mr. Armstrong said, well, we got to save it. So the queen took it back and gave it to one of her ladies-in-waiting to raise, to save the life of the baby. But what was interesting to me was when we sat down for lunch that day, is that the queen who, they're always kings and queens are waited on by people, and they don't do things for other people. Yeah, well, Mr. Armstrong, he couldn't see his lunch very well to open the packages. They're how they beautifully wrap things, so that they're birds and ducks, they're all sorts of decorative things, and they don't unwrap that easily, but they look wonderful. things that she's not supposed to do, and so they don't know what to do. And they're mumbling about that. And so we finish lunch, and Michelle wants to go to the restroom. And so she gets like, asks the lady waiting where the restroom is, and there's kind of an outhouse type thing there. It had run some running water somehow through a tank, but it was rather crude. And it kind of looked like an African hut, you know, straw hut down with the round, you know, stone walls. And as my wife started walking toward it to go in, the queen got up out of her chair and ran over there and stopped my wife from going in the restroom. She said, "Wait here." And she went in and cleaned the restroom for her before she'd let Michelle go in. And then she hands the wife to her and says, "Use these. Don't use the water. You might get some bacteria and some bugs and have to hurt you." And I sat there and thought, no. And then the staff, of course, going nuts because they had the queen go clean a restroom for you. You think, man. How many kings and queens in the world would do something like that? And we were with Princess Diana and Charles down next to the gardens, and they wouldn't let us near the restroom when Princess Diana was in there. Michelle had to go, and they said, "No, you got to wait, no matter how long it is." But different mentality. But to see the queen do something like that, you know, how many of us would do that for someone else? Whether it's, well, yeah, we might do it for our boss or for royalty, but we do it for each other. Michelle doesn't have a title. She's not anybody. We're not wealthy. We're not anything special. And yet here the queen's doing this. Remarkable. And then you understand that when you see that happen, you think, you know, here's someone who doesn't have God's Spirit, yet can do something like that, not considered the Lord. And you know, we have Christ's example, washing the feet of the disciples. Do we have that kind of attitude toward each other? No. Willing to help. Or is it just in your family or in your group, or is it just up the ladder? Do we see government again? What did Christ say? He that is greatest seek to be the servant. Do we serve? We criticize an awful lot. We complain. We get territorial. We do these various things sometimes, but should we not be serving each other? Helping each other? Giving? It doesn't make any difference. You know, when Christ did things for people, he had no Christians to do them for. When you think about who's my brother, Christ said, everybody's your brother. Even out of the church. That might be more difficult to do some things for them. And sometimes they may not allow it. They'll assume wrong motivation, perhaps, if you do. But that's what it's about. If we really come to understand that fully and completely, that's what Christ did. It's what the two trees are about that Mr. Armstrong talked about. The tree of knowledge of good and evil. Mr. Armstrong saw it as the tree of death, which it is. The tree of life. The problem was the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Some of the people never understood that tree. When I talked to Mike Brazell, he said, "Well, you know, I was always taught that good people are Christians and the rest of the world is pagan and evil. So the tree of life is good people and the tree of death is bad people. Therefore, when I went to Azusa Pacific, I saw some wonderful people there. They were so good and giving. Therefore, since they were good, they had to be off the tree of life. They had to be true Christians." Well, no, it's the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And some people can be very good off the tree of death. Mother Teresa is off that tree. She helped all sorts of people with leprosy and everything else, diseases. You can be very good off that tree. Then you can have Hitler and Stalin and Genghis Khan and everybody else off that tree as well. It's a mix. And the motivation, the action is great. Motivation in some ways is commendable, but it's not the tree of life. The tree of life is Christ. We had nothing we could do for him. He had everything he could do for us, but he didn't. You don't know the reason. I've said, you know, the act looks the same off the tree of life as the tree of knowledge of good and evil. If you see out there and see somebody helping, somebody gets a flat tire, you see somebody helping. You know, maybe it's a young girl, somebody's helping change her tire. Well, you do it because you really want to help her, or you do it because you want to date. Maybe you like the girl. Maybe he's hitting on her. You know, you don't know. The motivation is only from the heart. You can see a good act and you don't know. And those good acts are wonderful. I love being close. I have neighbors. I have some good Baptist neighbors. You know, people that are good at their religion make good neighbors. As Bernard always said, people who practice six of the seven laws of success and get wealthy, they won't be happy. You practice the seven laws of success, and the more you practice them, the more successful you are. You know, you practice the rules of marriage, the Bible, the more of them you practice, the better your marriage, whether you're in the church or out of it. Those rules are rules that are there for a purpose. They're things that play out. And so we need to understand that that's what it's about. wouldn't have stayed worldwide, and there are friends of mine who are still in worldwide because they think they can't leave, who disagree. And, you know, God's their judge, not me. And you know, I say, hey, if you can hold on. And in a few churches where there's enough people, where in one group was about 20 of them, after church they go back and tear apart everything the minister said that was wrong against the Bible. So they're able to pretty well hold on, but if you're by yourself in a church, it's kind of hard to go out and, you know, do it yourself, and things rub off. And sometimes you don't realize how many things you do start doing unless you have contact. There's a lot of material out there. A lot of things, Mr. Armstrong, if you're internet friendly, everything Mr. Armstrong ever wrote is on the internet at several locations. We broadcast everything. And it's fascinating how much work is being done after his death in that way. Now, there's a lot of garbage on there, too. A lot of people that have hatred and bitterness. And that's out there as well. Misinformation, because very little of it is true, although like I said, the grain of truth, and people mix it up. Well, Christ, he's coming back soon. We don't know exactly when. I think it's sooner than later. Everything that's happening in Europe, everything that's happening in the world, everything that's geometrically and exponentially just climbing to decay. The finances of the world, having a degree in finance, the finances of the world are a tinderbox. It's a house of cards. The derivatives and things that are leveraged. I mean, the whole world's economy is leveraged dozens of times over. I mean, the slightest thing can make it collapse. When you look at morality, there is none. Anything goes. No one can agree on any code of morality, so therefore we have no code of morality. Anything's right to do in your own eyes. You know, the people are becoming one language again, almost like Babylon, because of computers. Everything is connected. And, you know, when is God going to pull a plug? Whenever he wants. And we can't tell when it is. I'm always fascinated. It doesn't mean anything, but I'm fascinated when I read some of the pagan prophecies. And, of course, we know that demons are lying spirits and things, but I find it fascinating myself that every time you look at Notre Dame, or you look at South America, or even the King of Thailand, the prophecy is there that says that 200 years ago, an old woman walked up when they crowned the Rama one and said, there will be 10 King Ramas, and that after that, the end of civilization. You know, the Pope, the English monk who back in 1050s who wrote the book, who said that there'd be 112 popes, and we're on 110 now, and this one's about to die. In the Mayan calendar on the cave, they did this thing on a Discovery Channel, and the scientists and mathematicians and astronomers did their calendars on the wall and found out they're only 5 seconds late off. You know, it's 500 years since they died out, and they're 5 seconds off on their calendar if you project it. And it ended the story with, oh, and by the way, the calendar says civilization as we know it ends in the year 2012. All over the world, the same things are ending at the same time. It doesn't mean a whole lot, except to me, I always wonder, what do the demons know? Well, they know when creation was. Now, Christ said no one knows when it's going to end, except God. We do know there's a 6,000, 7,000 year plan. We know a lot of things. I often wonder if 6,000 years is in 2012. Again, speculation. But just from the standpoint of they can count and they know when creation was, well, is that something that they can give? Well, the world's ready for it. And that could go beyond that. It could be sooner than that. The days are cut short. We don't know. But to me, it's something that kind of stimulates me to get on the ball a little more. And maybe there's not a whole lot of time left. Because if you've got to subtract, cut the days short, and take out 3.5 years of the tribulation, move that, then we're almost there. And yet, if it doesn't happen exactly that time frame, then God knows, but it's soon. There are scenarios that have been written up by some of the great minds of this world that say, in fact, in the one book he wrote, 7 scenarios, any one of which will bring on World War III. And his comment is, one of them will happen. It's just a matter of which one. So even man humanly knows it's about over. And here we are. What does it say at the end time? The bride will make herself pure. So there'll be a great falling away. I mean, all the scriptural things have happened. There's just a little bit to go. We've got to not worry about some of the pettier things and start concentrating on the spiritual things ourselves and each other and helping. Because God has some things in store for us that we don't even know. Again, the Bible says that. Creation waits for it. We don't know what's in store for us. But it's interesting that the chapters that I go to, Jude, and put a couple of scriptures in it, by just quoting them, the sermon. But in Jude, when God
Verse 24, it says, now unto him that's able to keep you from falling and to present you faultless before the presence of his glory with exceeding joy. I think about the first time I was presented to a king. Mr. Armstrong, I was standing in the background where I was supposed to be. Mr. Armstrong turns around and says, Your Majesty, may I present to you Aaron Dean? So Aaron, he pulled me out there and he says, and he presented me to him. And he said, this is a product of what we produce. And I felt funny being a product, like a little glass jar you're supposed to spin around and people look at you or whatever. Because, you know, I had 12 years of Imperial, and I had 4 years of Ambassador, and then I had 12 years of Mr. Armstrong. And, in fact, Mr. Armstrong, one time he was chewing me out, and he stopped. He said, you know, I don't want to be hard on you, Aaron, but he says, I'm responsible for you. All your education came from me, and if you don't get in, I'm going to be held liable for that. But to be presented in that way, and to understand what it means to be presented, again, in Colossians. Colossians 1:22. Nope, in the wrong place there. Yeah, verse 21. And you that were sometimes alienated and enemies in your mind by wicked works, now he has reconciled. Verse 22. In the body of his flesh through death, to present you holy, unblameable, unreprovable in his sight. You are going to be presented to God. We know the last great day is coming up when judgment is, and to the wicked he goes to the lake of fire, and the others join God and his family. I can just imagine what it would be like to have Jesus Christ say, may I present to you Norbert Link or Brian Gale or any of the others here. The feeling that that's going to be, to know that Christ helped you to become blameless before God, to become a king and priest. And that's what it says. You'll be kings and priests. You reign 1,000 years and then you go on for eternity as part of his family. That is what it was all about. It's about relationships. Man can deal with things. He's made things that can destroy himself. God builds relationships. And it's those relationships that you and I need to be able to make in his kingdom. And it takes humility. It takes sacrifice. It's difficult. But it's all worth it. And when we're protected and spared from what's coming, and we're taught, and God trains us, I look forward to my cities or whatever God chooses to give me. I look forward to seeing Mr. Armstrong again, and people have asked me, won't you be glad to tell him what happened? I said, no, if I'm that concerned with what happened in the past, I probably won't be there in the future. It'll be too exciting. It'll be too many things wonderful. The petty things will have gone away, and the important things will be there. Because you're going to get given a bunch of people that are just like you were. And they have to grow. The millennium, Mr. Armstrong talked about it would take 2 or 3 or 4 generations before people understood and started getting out. But it's kind of like the commandment, the third one that says, you know, don't take God's name in vain. He visits the iniquities upon the fathers, upon the children to the third and fourth generation. For me, as a little kid when I read that, I thought, man, I wonder if my great-grandfather did something wrong. Because God's after me. Lack of understanding, because you know God doesn't chase you down because your grandfather did something wrong. But the key is, if you do something wrong, your children pay for it. And they're not as prepared for parenting as they should be, and it automatically goes down the ladder. At the same time, when I did marriage counseling, I always told the kids, I said, when you get married, you have children. Honor your father and your mother. You owe it to them to raise them better than they raised you. And if you do it as well as they raise you, you've probably succeeded because the world has gotten worse. By the same token, in the millennium, people will learn a little better. And so after a few generations, by improving how it's done, some of that will be washed out. Yeah, the land's perfect. The rain, the animals, but people won't be. People will have to be taught. And they have to make the choice. It would be nice if God would turn our little instinct switch and we'd all be wonderful people, but we don't have one. And God says, choose life. And so that is what we're trying to choose. And we're here today commemorating the millennium and what that pictures and beyond. Appreciate having the opportunity to talk with you. And it's certainly a pleasure and something I do gladly. And like I said, I love all the people of God. It's one thing that probably Mr. Armstrong did. He loved the people of God. He missed being able to go out in the congregation and just mix. A lot of people think, he couldn't shake hands with that many people. He just got to the point where he just couldn't physically handle it. But he missed it. The other thing he missed, he said, was just reading the Bible. Because he lost his eyesight, he couldn't read anymore. Like the Bible I have here has his name on it. It's one that someone gave him. It's fairly large print. I actually need it now. But he gave it to me because he couldn't read it. He said, here, you read it. Well, I already had one, but I was sure glad to take this one too. He got down to where he had 3 volumes of the Bible. Big type. And then he couldn't read that anymore. In fact, when he was in his home the last few months, he asked me one time, he said, I'm looking for something. I need to write up. It's something Christ said to somebody. Could you find that for me? I said, well, can you be a little more specific? Well, I'm not sure what it is I want, but so we started reading Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John. Well, maybe it wasn't in the gospel. Maybe it was something Paul said. So we read Acts. We went through the whole New Testament over a couple, 3 days. He's the only person that could listen longer than I could talk. I'd be hoarse. I used to pray for the 7 o'clock news so that he would watch TV so I could recover from reading all day. I'd come home hoarse. I practically went blind reading in the dark. I didn't even realize it because you don't notice it. I went into his house with 20/20 vision. I came out 6 months later with 20/200. Couldn't read the signs. Like, what happened? But I think he just wanted to hear the Bible read again. He missed reading it. I mean, he was so good. He wanted to quit doing the telecast because I can't read the scriptures. I said, Mr. Armstrong, quote them. They'll know you know them. And that's even more impressive because we'll put it on the screen under there. Well, okay. And so he would. Because that's the thing. It becomes a way of life. You don't memorize it just for knowledge. Like Paul says, for knowledge it fails. 1 Corinthians 13. Love is important. It's a way of life. Do you do it automatically? What does Christ say to those who let's enter the kingdom? He says, well, I was naked, you clothed me. I was hungry, you fed me. And I was in need of shelter, and you gave it to me. And they said, well, we didn't do that. Yes, they did. They did it to others because of the second nature. And to the others who didn't do it at all, well, I would have done it. If the king had come or crown Prince Charles would have come to my house, I'd have fed him. If somebody else, somebody important would have come, if the minister would have come, no. Who's important? The value of every human being is to be a future king and priest. My first order on the airplane from Mr. Armstrong, you treat every person that gets on this plane as a future king, as a king, because they are future kings and priests. And so everyone that got on that plane, whether they were 2 years old or 20 years old or 90 years old, was treated like a king, because that is your destiny.
We are going to ask some questions, and as I said, those of you who have questions, I suppose you have to come forward and ask them into this microphone, and then we'll hand the microphone over to Mr. Dean for an answer. So who wants to start? Go ahead, sir.
Looking back over this period for the church, is time the vital factor, do you think, that in God and Christ's plan? Do you think the work at that level had to end, and that was God's way of ending it, by letting people come in who would take a different path, and the church would be split? But then the sifting and sorting can go on within the church. Truth can be restored, if there's still truth to be restored, and as we're coming up to the end, we've still got a witness and warning going out, but at a lower level. And I wonder if it's all a matter of time that God the Father has planned to the second.
Okay, well, we know God's in charge, and therefore anything that gets done because of Him. As far as the witness and warning, and how much, Mr. Armstrong, obviously we went to a lot of nations. We didn't cover every nation in the world because, well, there's new nations now that weren't even there then. Interesting enough, when we went to Kenya and someplace in Africa, the tribal boundaries, the place where the British put the lines is not where the tribes were, unfortunately. That's why you have all these fighting. One of his lectures he gave was translated into 4 different languages and sent over the border to other countries that we didn't even visit. There were things that reached there that happened during that period of time. We do know the Bible talks about a famine of the word. In fact, that's one of the comments I made when the council, in the council sometimes, where I am, we talk about the fact doing a work and doing this and trying to define it. It's tough. But the key is I thought, how many people want to be doing a great dynamic work while God's having a famine of the word?
I said, if you succeed, you failed. And if you fail, you succeeded. Now the point is, my desire, as I said, my desire is to do as much as we possibly can. Well, my problem is how do we spend our $12.95? That's about all we have left. This is like after everything's paid.
Oh.
So it's almost to me like God is controlling how much we can do by how much resources he gives us. Now we can know he can raise up people to send in millions of dollars. Like he could have Bill Gates give us a couple billion. Well, he probably lost half his fortune in the last stock crash, but you know, maybe only half a billion. But it's not happening. There are still some people being called, not nearly as many. There are some that have spent a lot of money on television and doesn't seem to produce a whole lot. God is in control of how much is being done and what. So there's no question he has a timetable for some of that. Are we in the period of the famine of the word? Are we in the period when God says the power of the holy people is broken? Is that Israel, or is it the church, or is it both? Is it dual? There are so many things that are dual in place that it's hard to tell. From my standpoint, and I've been asked the question about Elijah a number of times. You know, Mr. Arson sent Elijah to come, because at times he would say something like that, and other times he'd go back, and then sometimes it'd be the church is doing Elijah work. In his mind, while he really believed for a long time that he'd be able to Christ return, you know, he had to realize he looked at the scriptures and he read them and things that were supposed to be done before the end. If you in your mind believe, I'm going to be here till Christ returns, these scriptures are all going to be fulfilled. Therefore, the only logical conclusion is I have to do these. And he went about doing them as hard as he possibly could. Now, about 5 months before he died, give or take a week or two somewhere in there, he finally made a comment, and that was when he was trying to decide who he should appoint and all those things. He said, no, God's time is not the same as ours, and I can see I'm going to die. And so he realized at that point that he wouldn't be here till Christ returned physically. And again, you have to think of the Apostle Paul saying, those of us who are alive and remain, you know, here we are 2,000 years later, he's been dead a long time. And I often wonder, how could the disciples, they knew about the 7,000-year plan, they knew the days of the week, and yet, did they think God was going to cut it 2,000 years short? Is that what they thought? And then here's Mr. Armstrong, obviously a lot closer to 6,000 years than they were then, and he felt the same way. And I thought of Daniel. Now, Daniel, what does he think? God, what does this mean? God says, Daniel, it's not for you to know. And when I look at Mr. Armstrong, a lot of the things that he did, some of the areas where he was kind of forced to speculate in a way, you look at it and you think, you know, really? Let's put it this way. How many of you think Mr. Armstrong really needs to know where the place of safety is? You know, he's not telling me anything. It was something he doesn't really need to know. And some of those areas of prophecy, you wonder, are these things that God really didn't point out? And sometimes people would try to corner him in areas. And there are some subjects you find very little about because his way of dealing with things that he wasn't told was don't preach them. So there are some areas where there's some scattered things where people would force him into things and he would read them, and he'd read what was there. And what was there is absolutely, you know, like I can read a chapter in Revelation and say, this is absolutely going to happen exactly as it said. Now the minute I start not reading the text, I'm doing some speculation because it may or may not happen exactly the way I say. Although the scripture's going to happen, you know, if I pick out 10 kings, it may not be the 10 I pick out. You know, like maybe one dies and somebody else gets in, you know, or something else. But yet there are 10 kings that give their power to the beast. You know, I can put a name on the beast, but maybe the wrong beast. So some of the things, Mr. Armstrong, again, because in some ways he felt he'd be able to the end, he tried to go after those prophecies and do them to the best of his ability. And he certainly did. If the Elijah work is as we interpret in the sense of preparing the way for Christ and witnessing and things, my comment is that if it's an 8-lap race, Mr. Armstrong is 7 laps ahead of anybody else. Because we were at 8.95 million plane trees going out every month. In fact, I had a statement that I was going through my notes before I came to the feast and saw an old paper, 1986, the year he died. And they were given the thing that they list, because they give the minister sometimes some of the things, the milestones in the work, so you can encourage the brethren. And you know, I think about the different groups. You know, we reached 50,000 magazines or 100. Here's this thing. This year, we sent out 110 million pieces of literature. Well, how long is it going to be before you or us or anybody else, all of us combined, send out 110 million pieces of literature? You know, this year, we've spent $27 million in around 456 television stations. And I read that. Yeah, we're on a couple PBS stations, you know, whatever. And I think, you know, if we say he didn't do the Elijah work or that wasn't it, then that means we better do more than that. To even qualify. And maybe someone will. You know, I don't know how long time will go on per se, and maybe, I don't think so. And then again, as far as witnessing, how much of that did he do versus how much of that for the two witnesses? I mean, they are called the two witnesses. So, I mean, how much of that did they do? And how much will we do it too? And then how much of that has God prepared his bride and has and filling in the gaps, per se, of people? You know, when you read about the 144,000, it says this is all those who were killed and rise and meet him. And the question I have, and I'm studying into it more now, is it totally 144,000 throughout history that is the first resurrection? I mean, it really seems to read that way. And some of those things. So you look at that and you wonder, you know, how much do what Mr. Armstrong did being so focused help build the bride of Christ as far as the church? And how much of it was for going to the world of the witness, which he felt he had to do. Matthew 24:14, this gospel will go to the world. And so therefore, if I'm alive, I'm going to be here till he returns. That scripture's there. It hasn't been done. I'm going to go do it. And God lets us do a lot of things that we may or may not need to do. But in my opinion, yeah, he certainly fulfilled the role in type, just as others, like John the Baptist. Like, yet the other question, it says Elijah will come and restore all things. Well, if Mr. Armstrong was Elijah come and restore all things, how come everybody else out there hasn't been here with us? I mean, restoring all things, everything. Is that something Christ does? And of course, you know, Elijah shall come. Yeah, Mr. Armstrong shall come again too. And those who died in the faith, and Elijah, and will come back up. Maybe I mean, the way God does it isn't exactly the way we want it always. When God resurrects all of us, we'll all be helping restore all things. Elijah, Armstrong. So, I mean, how much does that play over into that future? Again, we try to interpret things a certain way, and then we realize, every time I see God do things, he doesn't do them the way I want them. And I don't know why he didn't take my advice, but for some reason it seems to come through the back door or the side door or left field or right, you know. And afterwards I look back and I think, boy, that's the perfect way to do it. But if I were Thomas Armstrong, you know, the best way to purify the church is to have somebody in charge that changes all the doctrines. And then we all decide what we're doing. Mr. Armstrong would have shot me. But, I mean, in reality, same first century went through the same thing. People crept in. I mean, read the first century. If you look at the first years, you know, Christ died 31 AD. The church grows. By 50 AD, the apostasy goes in. Then there's the growth. And by 90s, everything kind of falling apart. Just a few scattered people. It's almost a parallel, you know, 1900 years later. So from the standpoint of God knows. There's no question. His timing, when it comes, how it happens, how many people are involved, who does it, are all his. And Mr. Armstrong bears the place of honor and respect in his ability and his tenaciousness in order to give up advertising and a career. I mean, some people say, well, it's a shame Mr. Armstrong lost his family and because he didn't spend time with his kids and things over the church that God had him do. Mr. Armstrong was that way in advertising. God tends to call people that have a certain personality, a certain type, and they do things. And Mr. Armstrong, when he was in advertising, he worked 20 hours a day. And he was doing that anyway. And when God called him, he knew that. Just like the Apostle Paul, he was a zealot killing everybody, and now all of a sudden he's a zealot going the other way. He uses people for those talents. You know, he doesn't make people necessarily do things per se in the sense that, you know, I gotta make you sacrifice. But he uses people that are willing to do it and willing to serve, people who have that in their nature. And Mr. Armstrong had a tenacity that carried. I mean, like I said, we didn't take time off. We worked all the time. We wrote, you know, morning till night. It was about getting it done. And mostly because I'm old, I'm going to die, Christ's supposed to come. How long can I keep doing this? I better do it faster and more of it. But it's funny because I did, you know, the 70s, like 1976, we were gone 312 days out of the country, out of the U.S. We were in Paris more than I was at home that year. If I'd have moved my wife to Paris, I'd have seen her more. I didn't, because I didn't know that until the year was over. But it was interesting because I was only gone, I did 3-week trips usually, about as much as I wanted to handle, and I did 4 or so, about 90, 100 days a year we'd be gone. We did more visits in the 80s in any one year than we did in the whole decade in the 70s, before, when we were spending a lot more money, and gone all the time. So we covered a lot of ground, but it's funny because I would try to go into a country, we'd set up the meeting the next day, and then we'd go to the next country. And our last trip, in 24 days, we did 9 countries in 24 days. He was 91, 92 years old. And it was interesting because once we were in a place and we're sitting there, there's nothing to do. And, well, who are we meeting today? I said, well, nobody. I've got to get things done. I'm old. You know, I'm going to die pretty soon. I can't waste time like this. Why don't we do something today? I said, well, there's just nobody to visit. And Then another time I had two meetings in one day, and we did the first meeting, and I said, well, now we have to go with the... I'm old. Are you trying to kill me? I can't work this hard. So I really couldn't win very easily. But at the same time, it showed his mindset was to get the work done, but then sometimes he'd get tired and cranky too. I mean, there were times when he'd get tired and you know, you had to kind of play with him. I used to have him call back on the Sabbath and make some comp overseas in the microphone, and one day I walked in, had it all set up, and I'm too tired. I can't do this. You're just working me too hard to kill me. I said, that's okay. It's done. It's over. Start putting it away. He said, no, don't worry about it. I'll do it. Oh, well, maybe I could say something. Well, no, that's fine. You're tired. You know, you always knew if you got the mic in front of him, he'd take off. but once I shut it down, the device, you don't want to do it, fine. I'll put it away. Once I start putting it away, then it kind of changed. But he was fun to work as a human being. That's why I said most people never knew him as a person. And the things I would tease him with, you know, I brought one of those dogs, the leashes without the dog, you know, you sniff along with, you know, visible dog. I take on the plane once and I up there and start rubbing his leg. And he got it with his eye and he goes like this, you know, looks down there and sees it. He says, I hope your dog is trained. You know, things like that. You'd play with it. He had a lot of fun with it. It was, you know, cultural thing you wouldn't do that. I picture the apostles of Christ having a good time with things and enjoying each other. And unfortunately, nobody ever saw it. They only saw the side of him at the pulpit and teaching and the writings and things. And he was fun. And I do things in South Africa. The whole ministry lined up once there, and I came in with the luggage and got everything done, and he saw me there. He said, "Oh, Aaron, I want a glass of sherry." And I said, "No, Mr. Armstrong, you can't have any." Man, he shows in the ministry. and he says, "That man's a real taskmaster." But it wasn't good for his heart. He knew I'd say that, but everybody in the room didn't know that. Why to tell him no? It's kind of, you know. But that was what he's supposed to have. I'm, what good are you as an aide if you don't do what you're supposed to do? You don't say what you're supposed to say. But it was fun. But other people didn't know that level. Some of the early church people did long, long ago. And he missed, like I said, meeting people and seeing them and talking to them. But he was altogether human but fun. And Mr. Armstrong, like I said, I think of the apostles, how they were, and you know, and all the things they did, arguing among themselves, stuff which we still do. Hasn't changed a whole lot. But Christ had to be a lot of fun to be with too, and so those things that, to me, it's got to be fun to be in God's family. It's going to be happy and enjoyable. And the world has made religion the monastical, clerical, no fun, you know, dark and everything. And you know, if you look at what the monasteries are with nothing and black robes, and you think of God's city described the pearls, the jewels, and the light, and the brightness, and you think, well, we've really got this messed up. It's supposed to be fun. I mean, this life is, you know, yeah, the world criticizes, we have a lot of tribulation and stuff, but overall, we like each other, we're fun. And that's really, it's supposed to be that, within the last mouth of God's law.
Next question. Oh, he's right.
Okay. I have a question too, but I defer to you first. Go ahead.
Do you feel that Mr. Armstrong felt that his second wife, Ramona, was a converted person because subsequent events proved a little bit different?
Well, obviously he felt he was converted, he wouldn't have married her, so he felt that way. And she actually was a fairly nice person. I enjoyed talking with her, because the year before they were married, we spent a lot of time talking. There are people that think that it was a setup by Stan Rader and others to have him marry her so they control him. That's not true. She actually hated Stan Rader. She really did. Just like most other people did. But it was interesting, and I say that seriously, because she threatened not to keep the Mercedes-Benz he gave her as a wedding present. And you got to really dislike somebody not to take a Mercedes. She was a younger woman, and she didn't know she wanted to marry him, really. The thing is, Mr. Armstrong was on the plane. She was Godot's secretary. She ended up flying with us. In fact, I remember the first time she flew on the plane with us in late 74 to 75. And like I said, it was after DNR had changed and everything. So Mr. Armstrong had nothing to do with her before that. People think he changed it so he'd get married. No way. He wasn't even interested. But she was on the plane. Of course, she was small and kind of visually looked at. She was younger and could keep up with the travels if anybody can keep up. And he started liking her. But again, it was the only person he was seeing in the church from the standpoint he was traveling. Unfortunately, Ted Armstrong had reasons why he wanted his father God. And Stan Rader had reasons why he wanted Mr. Armstrong not near headquarters. That's where the thing came up. Well, your headquarters, wherever you are, is headquarters, which is true, but the reason for saying that was to keep him away, not because that was true, because we didn't need to sit in hotels for 10 days at a time overseas, which I did. Like I said, we did a lot more later without sitting in any hotels more than a day or two. But that being said, he saw her, he was a companion, he was lonely, and he got lonely. It's like anybody would after you know, having been married with a good marriage, and then and wanting companionship. And she was there. And he started talking to her. She's very pleasant to talk to. She didn't really want to marry him per se. She knew she'd be taking care of his things. At the same time, you know, the age difference and stuff was in her mind. And should I marry him just to help him? You know, Abigail, some of David's wives, the last one obviously didn't, you know, he didn't know her. She never had sex with her and things. So, there, you know, do you do something because you should do it or not? And she kind of went back and forth. And she married him. Then he had his heart attack. And then, unfortunately, her character wasn't as much as it should have been. There were some things happened. At that point in time, unfortunately, she drifted away, and it was a problem. And then she kind of joined the other side when things fell apart, only because I'd say honor among thieves, kind of that old category. And once you know something about somebody, they do something wrong, you can kind of blackmail them. And unfortunately, people aren't beyond that. And people do those things, especially without God's Spirit. Whether she was converted, she was in the church a long time. I mean, she had been baptized, you know, 20 years before or so, or 15, 18 years, somewhere in that neighborhood. And so she'd been around quite a while. He thought she was. Later on, she did things obviously that didn't fit. My hope is, I mean, she's still alive. My hope is she would come back to the truth and understand. I mean, we've got other people that made mistakes and have come back, so I don't see a problem that way. But he felt she was converted, to answer that question. And things happened and events happened that created a situation that she got caught up in. And he wanted to make the marriage work. And then when the divorce came, there was really no choice. Yeah, he had no choice at all. And he realized he made a mistake. But it wasn't anything that anybody in the Bible couldn't have done the same way. Yes, another question?
Thank you. Maybe I can just mention something here, because I'm one of the very few people, I believe, who have been able to see all the letters, the personal letters, which were written between Mr. Armstrong and Ramona Armstrong. The reason I saw these were because in preparation for the lawsuit which was going on. And I can only confirm what Mr. Dean just said. Mr. Armstrong desperately tried to save that marriage without any question. Also, I want to confirm the fact that I do have that document Mr. Dean was talking about earlier, in which it is clearly stated and signed by Mr. Armstrong that he did not appoint Mr. DeCarch to the office of apostle. That was specifically excluded. All right, next question. I believe Mr. Gale had a question.
Thank you. I've got two questions. The first one, I hope, is brief. There are those who think that everything that was in place on the 16th of January 1986, when Mr. Armstrong died, cannot be changed. What's your understanding?
Well, if the Bible says you grow in grace and knowledge, you have no choice but to grow. Mr. Armstrong, he learned more every year than he did the year before. Obviously, there are some things that God has yet to show us. Like I said, such as the place of safety and other things that will come about. And it's not Mr. Armstrong going to tell us, and it's not something we necessarily knew. I mean, if we do go to Petra, then perhaps you could say that, but it may be somewhere else, and, you know, who knows how God does that. But, you know, to me, the Scripture is what's sacred. And Mr. Armstrong, he would no more want us to keep believing something he taught if it indicated or came out the Scripture disagreed with it than Moses or Elijah or Abraham. Again, I often think if God resurrected Abraham and Moses, and they were standing right there, and Christ is talking to the Pharisees, and the Pharisees are saying, "Well, we have Moses, we have Abraham." Those guys would be sitting there going, "What is wrong with you, idiots? This is God. This is who we look to, and you're bringing our name up. We're out of this." And Mr. Armstrong said the same thing. You know, don't disagree with God. And so, from my standpoint, yeah, I go back to the core thing Mr. Armstrong did, and when I read the Bible and look at it, I read Mr. Armstrong's writings. But if there's something the Bible disagrees, I mean, he realized at the end, he never wrote that he wasn't going to be here until Christ returns. Yet there were times he wrote things and said that, you know, that he felt he was. So again, there are things that he believed that he had to realize were not true in those areas. Now, most of the doctrinal areas, yeah, the Sabbath, the holy days, the plan of God, there's so much volume and stuff. But if you were to get one of those sermons about Joshua and Zerubbabel, and I mentioned in the sermon, he would totally deny that now. And there are things out there he wrote in the early days that are different than things he wrote later. And there are some things he changed that he never wrote about later that became practice. So it's kind of hard to freeze it. And that's where a lot of people do freeze it. Others freeze it in other decades. So I wouldn't be trapped. I would certainly look at his writing like I said. I would lay his well above anybody else's humanly other than Scripture. and see if there's something. But I wouldn't go that far to say nothing's going to change or we're never going to grow, because if that's the case, we buried our tail in the sand. We haven't done anything. In fact, I get my mom's is with a group that kind of thinks there should be a work and new things. And I said, Mom, I got to keep trying. Even if, I'd rather have God come and say, why were you beating your head against stone trying to do a work when I was done with it, than to say, why did you quit doing a work and bury your head in the sand when you were still alive and could have kept doing something? And because it might be that God doesn't have a whole lot for us to do. But I'm certainly not going to be accused of not trying to do something. And so there are things that I keep studying. There are things Mr. Armstrong and I talked about that he wasn't sure on now that I'm becoming more sure of because of the study, because of his death, and because of the transition of things that are happening that lead me to a different conclusion in minor, you know, prophetic areas of things. Basic core doctrines. The things that were once delivered, the faith once delivered, those core doctrines. Let's face it, those core doctrines are the same ones the apostles had when he wrote the scripture back then. Those are the same ones Mr. Armstrong carried. But some of the things Mr. Armstrong about the United Europe and some of that, the apostles in the first century didn't know. So they weren't calling that a core doctrine. There were some things that weren't being called core doctrines then that would be things that we know. And so they knew where Israel was. We had to figure it out through faith and prophecy and things there that they knew.
I'd like just to get your view on our situation here in the UK, particularly as you worked very closely with Mr. Armstrong and saw him work in the international areas. What do you think Mr. Herbert Armstrong's view of the fact would be that very recently an evangelist from a foreign area has tried to impose a minister of his choice on us without any input from us whatsoever, particularly as that minister had been in two other organizations for the previous 7 years and was unknown to us personally and doctrinally? The rationale is that as the church is a spiritual organism, the church supposedly has no boundaries and that allows ministerial seniority to be extended to other areas. Now, we think there are many reasons why we don't agree with that action. Would you like to make a comment, please?
Well, in Mr. Armstrong's time, we had regional directors in one area didn't do things to regional directors in other areas. And to try to make a regional director in another group or another area assign something would, to me, be foolish. To me, right now, there's still a lack of trust, and rightfully so. I mean, look at what we've been through. And, I mean, there are people I do trust, people I don't, and they're not necessarily in one corporation or another. They're scattered around. If I want information about one thing, I may call one minister in one group. If I want information about something else, I'll call somebody else. I wouldn't expect anybody to trust anything, you know, with what we've been through unless it agrees with their Bible and rings clear. And so, you know, if someone wants to come and can help out and you can build that bridge and trust, then fine. But to make an edict like that, I don't think Mr. Armstrong would approve. I mean, obviously, if you had someone appointed by God who was over it and said, this is your minister, we all accept that. But in a day when, you know, I don't know who you are. I haven't heard any of your sermons. I don't know where you've been. You know, maybe you were a Trinitarian 8 years ago. Maybe you were this, maybe you're that. I'm not going to trust them to be up at the pulpit, you know, there. I mean, I can listen to them and look at my Bible and say, yeah, it's right or it's wrong. And I'll be looking at it with a magnifying glass, too. Probably more so than this, because everybody hates to be scrutinized that much. But I would, I certainly, from my standpoint, I don't think Mr. Armstrong would expect anything but caution in that regard.
Let me follow up on that. Is my understanding correct that, for instance, we had a situation in under Mr. Armstrong in Worldwide, just to give a few examples, where, let's say, Mr. Schnee was a regional director of Germany, and he was a pastor-ranked minister. And let's say you had, you know, Mr. Pardigan, who was the regional director over France, the French-speaking area, and he was an evangelist-ranked minister. Now, when Mr. Pardigan would visit Germany, he didn't suddenly become in charge over Germany only because an evangelist. Is that correct? I mean, Mr. Schnee was still in charge of Germany, even though he was a pastor-ranked minister.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, if someone was over an area, that was their responsibility, and it wasn't someone else's. Interesting to me, King Leopold, when he finally told Mr. Armstrong about Stan Rader after Mr. Armstrong removed him, Mr. Armstrong said, why didn't you tell me about him before? He says, not my job to judge another man's servant. I mean, he saw the position. But he said, now that you've got rid of him, he asked Mr. Armstrong, do you mind if I remove him off my board too? Well, Mr. Armstrong said, sure, go ahead. So he did. But that's the case. It wouldn't be that.
I saw Mr. Bob Latham had a question.
Mr. Gale has already asked
it. All right. Good. Wow, that's great. We're moving along here. Any further questions? Anybody? I can't believe you. There got to be another question. Okay, while you are thinking about one, I have one. Okay, hold that then, because I deferred to you earlier. You touched upon it already in the sermon, I believe, and also in some of the answers, but I want to get that perhaps emphasized one more time. Our understanding has been that the church has been giving all kinds of permissions, commandments, instructions as to what to do, including, of course, to preach the gospel, to feed the flock, to see to it that the hearts of the fathers would be turned to the hearts of the children and vice versa, to be a watchman or to be watchmen, to warn those who need to be warnings, they need to receive warnings and so on. And we all understand, I believe, there's no doubt about it, that Mr. Armstrong was fulfilling all these different tasks. My question, though, is when Mr. Armstrong died, according to what you understand Mr. Armstrong believed, would he have thought, okay, with his time of his death, all these different tasks, all these different commissions, however you want to call them, cease to exist? Or were there continuing, ongoing duties for the church to accomplish?
Like I said, he felt the incoming thing would drop, so therefore some of the things would cease economically. But he wouldn't want us to stop. And I think if he realized it's been 16 years now, going on 17 next January, obviously, the longer it goes on, the less he would even expect us not to do anything. I mean, if Christ would have come and the tribulation would have started within 6 months after his death, it would have been obvious to all of us that, yeah, he finished that part. You know, it's on for the kingdom. But now the time has progressed, and like he said, no, biblically, there's no scripture that says, you know, Herbert W. Armstrong dies, it's all over, just get ready. But again, we're back to defining the work. And I finally have come to the conclusion that the work is what God wants done when he wants it done. And if it's purifying the bride that he's focusing on now, which it seems to be because so many more people are having opportunities, in spite of our scattering the problems, more people are leading songs, especially, I mean, I've seen so many people involved in the church now that probably, you know, if you go back 10 years, we've just been sitting there in the middle of a 500-person congregation not doing anything. And so God's involvement in that part, how much we do as far as television or the work and the witness and the internet and the various things are again limited by finances, but we do everything we can. You do everything you can. Every one of us does what we can. And personally, I do a lot. If I get on an airplane, I end up talking about God's plans. It's easy for me to bring up things that happened. And surprised at how many people know about the plain truth of Mr. Armstrong still yet, 16 years after he's dead. And you start talking about my favorite line with most of them when they start talking about the feast or Christmas, Easter, and things. I just talk about the holy days and the plan of God. And my comment is, because most people are anti-Jewish, and so I just say, you know, the Jews are wrong because they don't accept Christ. But I said, they keep the days of God, but they don't understand the days that they keep. And they're kind of surprised. I said, yeah, they don't understand their own days because they reject Christ. But I said, Christianity doesn't understand Christ because they don't keep his days. And when you look at it, if you don't see Christ as the Passover, how do you really understand what the Passover is? If you don't understand Christ is the way to forgive your sins and through his Spirit and repentance, the days of unleavened bread, putting sin out of your life, it's only because of Christ. Pentecost, Christ is the first of the first fruits. How do you understand that unless you accept Christ? The Jews don't accept it. There's only one time Christ comes for them, that's the hero. But how do Christians understand it without keeping the day? You go to the Feast of Trumpets. Who comes at the last trump? Christ returns. He is the king. You know, atonement. Who qualifies over the throne to put Satan away and make it? Christ. Who rules for 1,000 years? Christ. Who does God give judgment over to in the last great day? Christ. And then what does Christ do? He gives it all to God at the end so God can be all in all. I said, who? You know, people that complain we didn't preach about Christ. Well, you know, come up there and give your heart. No, we didn't say that. But who does God think appreciates his son? The person who puts his son in the exact plan in the holy days the way God puts them, or the person who says, oh, I believe in Christ, I have given my heart to the Lord, and I'm all, you know, and doesn't keep any of the days. I mean, if you want to show respect to my son, you show him the things that I want him to do. You don't do the things, you don't say, well, I think Christmas is good, so I'm going to put Christ's name on that. I mean, that's what's funny. We keep Christ. We are here because we are keeping what God said he wanted for us to do for his son. And Christ is the biggest part of every one of these holy days. And yet those people would have us believe that we are not doing that. And that's what's so funny to me. And every time you tell people on an airplane that's outside, they sit there, they're fascinated by it. I'm shocked how many people say, this is incredible. Because, it, like I said, the Jews don't understand it because they reject Christ. The Christians don't understand it because they have his name only. In vain do they worship me, keeping the doctrines of men. And, of course, they never read their Bibles, most of them. And when they hear that, they say, wow. Keep trying to get
I never know when
hey,
I should stand up.
Anytime.
Is this on? Okay. There was another question. Let me just make one comment. You can already come up, Teddy. I say that on purpose because he keeps calling me Norman. But that's an interesting thing what Mr. Dean just said. It's interesting because we have been accused, as you know, that we didn't preach Christ before enough. You know, I have a whole set of Mr. Armstrong's programs on the book of Hebrews. I don't know, 13, 14 different tapes. I mean, you listen to this and you know it's just ridiculous to make that kind of an accusation. I mean, Mr. Armstrong very clearly talked about Christ all the way through in this book of Hebrews. Anyway, Monsieur.
Right. Did Mr. Armstrong give any indication that he thought that Mr. de Koch would subvert the church as he did?
Absolutely none. And again, he made him promise not to do any of that. And he also made him promise that any doctrinal things would have to go through the Council of Elders. And so, I mean, you know, it's like I say, if you have 12 people that you have to convince before it can be changed, that's a lot more difficult than just one person running off and putting doctrine in the church. Because there have been people that are, well, right now, there's in the churches that have one man rule, there are some doctrinal things coming into those through those men. You know, small things in most cases now, but some big things in some of them. And one of Mr. Fleury's people called me, as a minister, has been put out from his church last year, called me up, and he was talking about the various problems that they had, and what made him leave was the fact that in a minister meeting, they were told, you ministers are the ones that get to decide who in your congregation gets to go to place safety. And he said, in my Bible it says judgment is given to Christ. I can't decide who goes. And he asked the wrong question, and he got put out of church. But at least he was reading his Bible and disagreed and he left. So to me, you know, God's Spirit still works. People still grow. There's still things and they find things. And if someone goes far enough off, you know, people will see it if they have God's Spirit. Now, if they're following a man, they won't see it and they go. But then the question is, do they have God's Spirit and which way they're going? But Mr. Armstrong would have never appointed Mr. Koch. I mean, he was trying to protect the church. And he was, like I said, he was only saying this would happen based on prophecy. And yet, it makes sense. You know, if someone would have stood in the back of the room and said, hey, let's all quit keeping the Sabbath, we'd have thrown him out. It had to come up here. You know, someone that you were taught to respect, taught to give authority to and submission. And he said, well, you know, you got to be a Christian 7 days a week. You know, and that's what it's about, not just one day. And that was a master stroke. I had so many people say, if they change the Sabbath, I'm out of here. Oh, no, the Sabbath's okay. You can be a Christian on the Sabbath, but you're a Christian the other 6 days, too. So which day you worship doesn't make any difference. That was masterful. It really was. Because some of those people, oh, yeah, that makes sense. So well, if they go meet on Sunday or something, doesn't make any difference. But, hey, I'm a Christian 7 days a week, too. And 6 days shall you work, and the seventh day is the Sabbath. That's what makes me a Christian. So he would have never done that. And he'd be surprised in some ways. Like, I'd like to have had all the things that I was afforded there. And it was pleasant. And not having those things, you know, we're trying to rebuild that. Each group is trying to rebuild little pieces of it. And my question is, how much of that does God want rebuilt? And if we all got together, you know, if we got old people staying home together and old people believe they're still worldwide together, we could have enough to do something. How much? I don't know, but maybe God doesn't want those somethings we might choose. Maybe those somethings would rebuild an edifice that doesn't give us individually the same challenge that we have. I don't know. All I know is God's in charge, and this is the way He chose to do it. And as much as I would love to see everybody all together, I have a feeling that when we all show up in a place of safety, and my personal opinion is that God's going to take us there wherever it is, because nobody's going to listen to anybody. And so the point is, if I show up and someone else shows up and they are in a different corporation, if I'm sitting there saying, what are you doing here? I'm probably not going to be there. I'm going to be giving them a hug and saying, thank God there's at least two of us, and three, and four. Because if they're there, that means they were doing okay. And what corporation they're in or whatever is irrelevant to me in that sense. And like I said, I'll help anybody that I can help and give an answer to whomever. Like I said, Paul was out there talking to all sorts of people on Mars, here, and everywhere, and that's what we're to do. All I've known is I have Samuel's disease. And what I mean by that is Samuel's told to go ministry of 4 million to 23 to 27, and these people, they want to go on TV. Would you call it an act of God or a good business decision to give a freebie? Here, taste one of these cookies and you'll buy a dozen, right? I mean, it's not wrong to take something someone offers you, but to imply that God opened the door. And like one of the things I said is established before with the person who's over the media by time is, God opened the door for us, Mr. Armstrong. God, you know, I went in there and God gave me this, granted us this good time in the morning. Mr. Armstrong said, well, did God open the door for Matt Indy, who bought the half hour in front of me, and for Rex Humbard, who bought the half hour after? He realized if you have money in America, you can buy time. It was a good time, but it wasn't an act of God. Now, an act of God was in Sri Lanka. Festus Pereira, he's the minister of fisheries. Well, Mr. Responsible, I don't know. He was a friend of Mr. Armstrong. And we did a small project. We gave $10,000. We bought two fishing boats. And the people, they catch fish, pay for the boat. And then the money is paid for, buys another two boats, et cetera, kind of multi-level marketing floating plan. But it was funny because we're on TV there. Somebody got upset and wanted to take us off. Now, there's only one Christian in the diet. That's a Catholic, and that's Festus Pereira. Everybody else is either Buddhist or Hindu. They're going to take us off. They're talking in cabinet. Festus Pereira stands up in Parliament and says, wait a minute, Herbert Armstrong is good. What he says is good for this country. He needs to be on TV. We got to keep him on TV. Talk small and leave him on TV. Now, that's an act of God. But because you can't buy somebody off at that level and do something for that. And oftentimes, people will kind of paint these acts of God. And if you want to be arm to arm with a bunch of TV executives, all you got to do is take a first class ticket from Los Angeles to Las Vegas when they have their convention. And lo and behold, God opened these doors, Mr. Armstrong. I was on a plane with all these executives. Is that an act of God, or is that just looking at the calendar and saying, "If I fly on this day, they're there"? And people tend to do those things, and it really irritates me. I've seen God work. I mean, it is so miraculous when you see God do something that you can't believe. But yeah, you can create the illusion. What did Simon Magus ask for? Give me the power so I can create the illusion. Because that's all his religion was, is illusion. And it's sad for me to see people feel that they need to change their own history to look like they should be in charge. And not that they're wrong, not that they're necessarily their doctrines are wrong or beliefs or whatever, but subtly they can be. And again, if God appoints someone and it becomes obvious, and it will, because when God does stuff, it's obvious. You know, Moses, the 10 plagues of Egypt, the whole thing. The apostles, you heal people, you heal them. I mean, there are things God does. In Mr. Armstrong's case, I mean, give up his career to go through, you know, 28 years of poverty, 14 abject poverty, practically, and then to go through what he did for a cause, and then have to see what God did in leading him to growth and all these things. And if it's that easy to do, obviously the people that took over couldn't do it. I mean, they're a perfect lesson in mismanagement. No corporation would have an organization go down to 10% of what it once was without changing the board of directors a dozen times. So it proves that God was with them. And if God chooses somebody else, he'll show that too. And obviously when the two witnesses show up, it won't be too hard to see who they are. And hopefully we're protected somewhere and aren't part of it that way.
To tell us, that question always comes up, especially in women. And that's a makeup question. So the question is, why did Mr. Armstrong keep changing it back and forth, and what was his real understanding about makeup?
Actually, unfortunately, that was because women created that problem. It was the woman, Lord. Even back in the 50s, and I wasn't involved with it then, but Mr. Armstrong talked about it a number of times. A bunch of women came to him, and women were judging each other. And made him make, he never wanted to get involved with makeup. It's kind of like he was made to make a decision on something he did. Then he changed it back, and then he went back and forth. The last time, the reason it got taken off the last time is because Ramona, she didn't really want to go with him to meetings and stuff like that. And she was trying, and she would use makeup as her excuse. Oh, I can't go. I haven't done my makeup. Finally, you know how husbands are when the wife uses money for excuses. We become very carnal. We say things like, if that's the problem, then we'll get rid of it. And then you don't have to worry about not coming because you put on your makeup. So it kind of became that. And biblically, really, what his concern was, and the funny thing, his definition of makeup is different from mine. Mine makeup is anything that came out of the scars or anything. You know, it's just so happy to be across the face. So it's kind of one of those things where are you trying to help other people as much as you are trying to show vanity yourself versus that? But in his mind, like I said, in fact, Mrs. Armstrong, that's another thing that I found out from a lot of the ladies that I talked to ladies who are Mrs. Loma Armstrong in England back in the early days when it was no makeup. She'd go to the bathroom and say, "You are so ashen, you need to put some color on your cheeks." And it was a matter to try to look more normal than look like you stepped out of a mortuary. So what are you doing? Now again, you don't have to wear anything at all, that's fine. Obviously, if you don't wear anything at all, if it's a matter of pride, I'm poor and proud of it, or I can go without makeup, then you're just being in the same boat as you would be the other way, putting so much on, and are you trying to be a harlot? And, to me, it's the attitude of the heart and mind, and it wasn't so much what was in the bottle, it's the attitude. And it's just like when he made the comment, "I can't recommend any school. The education in this world is wrong. The only school I recommend is Ambassador College. This world's education is wrong." And thankfully, before he died, I wrote the article, and I took it to a red guy, Mr. Armstrong. I said, "What do you do when you want a good architect? What do you go to Dip to get the best? Where were they trained? College. We don't teach architecture in Boston. One of our kids wants to be an architect, what does he do? He just can't be one. Must be an engineer. Can't be one. All the things we don't teach, can't be one." I said, "Mr. Armstrong, the thing about it is, the education, if you're in philosophy and religion and those areas, that's where you get messed up. You're not going to get messed up with math and engineering and economics or drawing." And so, and I went through college. The reason he said, the question was asked, "Where can I go to school?" And when he studied school back in the early 1900s, you went to the college, you joined the fraternity, did that. I said, "Mr. Armstrong, peer pressure in high school is much greater than college. In high school, you were the same kid every day. In college," so I took my accounting stuff. In Cal State LA, there were 12 accounting classes. There were 12 business law classes. There were 12 principles accounting classes. There were, and I said, I could have the same schedule as another student I'd never seen. I might see him in one class, not the other. I didn't spend the weekend with him. I wasn't with him all day. I didn't have PE with him. And I went to church. And I stayed at home. So all my activities were the church. And yet I went to school with him. In college, you have less pressure if you stay at home and go to school. And so I didn't know that. I said, to tell our kids they can't get other degrees in other areas is to eliminate. I mean, God's a great builder, an architect. So you can't be like God, be an architect. So it didn't make sense. So sometimes I'm trying to make a blanket statement the way the question was asked, or I'm trying to make sure that you sort out the wheat and the chaff in your education or in makeup or whatever. And his advertising always came out because it was always, "Wipe the makeup off your face," or "Don't," and then he would say, "Why do they get these ideas? Mr. Marshall, look at the way you said that." Well, I did say it pretty strong. And it came to roost, the education came to roost because two kids applied for ambassador that had to be turned down because they didn't do the last 2 years of high school. And in their application, they said, "But we did what Mr. Armstrong wanted. He said that education was wrong, so our minister said we should drop out of school. We dropped out of school. We did what God wanted, and now we can't go to God's college." Mr. Armstrong said, "Don't we have anybody with any balance out there?" But I said, "Mr. Armstrong, that's why you need to make sure when you say something, it's clear what you mean." And again, that's kind of where that issue sat. So from my standpoint, he went back and forth only because it wasn't a major doctoral thing. It's really a matter of the heart and mind and what you're doing when you put it on. Other questions?
Yeah, I'm surprised that didn't come up yet. But that has been... There's some out there who want to... we all know that you shouldn't go against your conscience. But there's some out there who wanted to try to tell that going out on the Sabbath is a sin. What was Mr. Armstrong's take on that?
be held together. And I remember when I was counseling, I never told anybody you should get married. I said, look, I don't know why you love him. I don't know why you love her. I don't know what makes other people, and there are people that I really like and people I didn't like so well. And they had great marriages. And other people I like both of them, they didn't have a good marriage. So I don't know what makes somebody love somebody. And I said, look, if he moves out, I'm not moving in. You say, and the reason is, the people who say, like my wife and I, we were told not to get married. They tried to keep them apart. In fact, the dean of students called the minister and my wife's area, and her parents aren't the church, never were in the church. In fact, she came to college not knowing about the Sabbath, holy days, who's going to come home for Christmas when she came to college. That's how much she knew. That's why I married her, I can fool her. But it was interesting because she came with that background and didn't know anything. And of course, I was cradled to grave. At least hope to grave, hope it's not too soon. But when you look at that, you think, why do people marry each other? And with us fighting, they called back their parents and said, your daughter's going with someone the church doesn't approve of. Now you can imagine this, but they thought we were weird. Her parents thought it was weird anyway. What's this Feast of Tabernacles thing? What are these little booths? What is all this stuff? And they only let her come because they had no money and she had the work program and it was Christian. They didn't want to get into all the drugs and stuff, so she had to come. And yet, you can imagine a minister calling you, your parents, you've got this kid who's in this religion who's strange, and even their church thinks she's going with somebody that the church doesn't approve of. And so they spend their time trying to break us up. And then what was even funnier than that, the person the church didn't approve of on graduation is asked to fly with the head of the church. Duh. That doesn't make any sense either. And so, but I know that for if you make the decision that this is who I want, before you'll say, I want a divorce, you're going to do everything in your possible power to make it work. Now, if I had somebody else that we should get married, that's his fault. They did that. They said that we shouldn't. I have no one to blame. And the thing is, a lot of these people seem to need someone to blame to get out of a situation into it. And when I counsel, I want people to know that you made the decision. And you've got to say, I screwed up if you're going to move or do something differently. And that's where you should be, because that's the decision. I don't get on because, Norbert, you're in the legal office. You told me to do that, so you should pay this. I shouldn't. God, don't hold me accountable. It doesn't work. I'm accountable. And that's the way all of us should be with every law of God, is I am accountable. And we help each other. If you set an example, and yeah, you might be someone who doesn't ever go out on Sabbath, doesn't ever cook anything, and of those 8 children, absolutely none of them are in the church. Now, the mother and father are still, surprisingly enough. But the kids aren't. And they resent what they did to their kids in that regard. So, you know, what are you trying to do? Where's the balance? And again, make sure it doesn't go to human reason, because that can be dangerous. And but at the same time, it's hard to know.
Thank you. Well, since we talked so much about food, we might as well take advantage of that. Well, again, Mr. Dean, thanks very much, and Mrs. Dean, for coming over here. We really appreciate your visit. And bring all our greetings back to when you go back this afternoon. Okay, and you all have a nice lunch and whatever activities planned this afternoon, this slide drive, whatever it was, you know. You go right ahead.